Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio.
Oh boy.
This is the fifth. I can't believe it, because I only thought we'd have maybe one, maybe two of these, right? Because, you know, to get this kind of an incredible group together is like a dream come true. And so but we only have a couple of the doctors right now, and usually Brian Artis checks in a little bit later because he's busy. Jim Thorpe sometimes has work to do during the show. John Cullen, our data genius, is pretty consistent all the way through. But we've got Jim. And John. And so what I want to do is just have you guys introduce yourselves, and then I'll bring in the other panelists as they come in. And so just a couple of sentences, just to kind of let folks know who you are, because the regular listeners who've been keeping up with the show know, but we always get new listeners all the time. So Jim, why don't you enter and sign in, please, and then we'll get to John.
Good morning, Greg, and good morning, John. Greg, thank you for hosting us on your great show again this morning. My name is Dr. Jim Thorpe. I'm a board-certified obstetrician-gynecologist and also board-certified in maternal-fetal medicine. And I'm privileged to be here with you this morning.
All right. John?
Hi, everybody. This is John Cullen, and I'm a guest on the show. My background is about 34 years ago when I was working at Oracle. I was the guy that put together the mapping system that today is considered the industry standard that's being used by Johns Hopkins, and a derivative of that's being used by the WHO to track the pandemic. And so I'm a data systems and mapping expert, and was one of the pioneers of geographic information systems when this system was built originally.
You know, it's funny you should say that. I'm going to ask you a question I was going to ask later in the show, but I want to find out what's going on with COVID in the world. So the good news and the bad news is that we only have two of you. The good news is you're going to get a lot more chance to talk. The bad news is, you know, our other panelists, you know, I'm sure Dr. Ben Marble and Dr. Brian Artis are somewhere in transit, you know, trying to get to us here. And, of course, other guests are going to join us as the hour goes on. But if not, you know, we got a lot of things to talk about here, and this gives us a chance to kind of expand and expound on certain things. So let me get the traditional ringing of the Wuhan gong in honor of the Wuhan China Lab, which may or may not be the origin of COVID. I sincerely doubt it at this point. I just like ringing the gong to get us started. There we go. So, John, let's actually start with you. Now that I think about it, considering your data and tracking, what is going on with COVID in the world? Is it even a news story anymore? Are there any outbreaks anywhere?
Oh, yeah.
Is it? There is. Okay, so let's get an update here. Tell me everything that's happening.
Actually, there's a very big headline that I just broke earlier today on Twitter. Mm-hmm. For those of you in the audience who are listening, you can follow me on Twitter at @I_M_JohnCullen, Cullen. And if you follow me on Twitter, you'll see that earlier today I posted a breaking news story that the World Health Organization, just today, is reporting that China has exceeded 20,000 deaths from COVID.
So, which most people don't know why that's news. it's fascinating. What do you mean? We have 1 million in the United States. Why is that news? So that's, right. I'll turn it back to you to explain exactly why that is news.
Well, it's news because it's what Malcolm Gladwell would call an outlier. China is the largest country on Earth with 1.4 billion people. It's where the outbreak supposedly started. It's, you know, we declared a global pandemic because of what we saw happening in Wuhan, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And yet today, the WHO, so this is, I'm on the WHO's website as we speak, they're reporting 20,102 people have died in all of China. Now, the reason that's kind of weird and remarkable is that Missouri has more dead.
So this is the total. This is over the entire COVID. This isn't just recently. This is from from when? From November 2019. When did they start counting?
Since the beginning.
So
So the WHO and Johns Hopkins both are using these mapping systems to show you country by country how many people have died. And this was the thing that first triggered my curiosity and interest in this was I was looking at very large countries like Vietnam. Vietnam has 100 million people. It's more than Germany. It's more than the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nobody dead in Vietnam. And so I was, well, that's kind of odd. There's this massive global pandemic and Vietnam borders China. And there's nobody dead in Vietnam. And then I looked at Mongolia.
Is there travel between Vietnam and China that you know of?
Yeah, there's a lot of commerce. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of commerce. And in fact, China dominates the region. I mean, you have to understand, if China dominates Walmart, China dominates, you know, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, the region. Are you kidding? There's a major trading partner.
I ask that for a specific reason, though, because what I'm wondering is if Vietnam is isolated from China, then they may not have as many COVID cases. But if there's a lot of commerce and a lot of border travel and traffic, then that takes out that variable. That's what I was asking.
So Thailand, so I was living in Thailand for 7 years, and Thailand is isolated from China.
Oh, okay.
There's no road that goes from China to Thailand without crossing through either Laos or Burma or Vietnam. You have to go through these other countries, and so that's one of the big reasons why Laos matters, is all of the commerce between Thailand and China has to, if it goes on the road, it has to go through Laos. So these are just, you know, local strange things. But the point was nobody was dying.
Yeah.
There wasn't anybody of, you know, there were no big numbers coming out of Southeast Asia. And I look at Mongolia and there was like three people dead in Mongolia. So when you start to look at the numbers that both the WHO and Johns Hopkins have been reporting, that was what triggered me early. And it's not because I'm a mapping expert. Anybody could look at the map. By the way, for those of you who are not familiar with these maps that I'm talking about, you can see them if you go to Drudge Report. So if you go to drudgereport.com, and if you're on a computer and you see three columns across the page, the middle column at the bottom says World Sick Map. And if you click on World Sick Map, that's the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health map. And again, the reason I was drawn into this was I took a look at this thing. And I was like, well, they did this all wrong. Yeah. I built the system, right? I know how it's supposed to be used. And something was wrong. And that got my hackles up, so to speak. So today, the WHO is announcing that China has 20,000 plus people dead total since the beginning of the outbreak. Massachusetts has more. Missouri has more. Indiana has more. So that's the cognitive dissonance. It's like, well, why? Wait. How is that even possible?
That's why I said the Wuhan gong, you know, because I don't think it came from. I did do that more as a joke at this point now. But and Jim, feel free to jump in here because I'm curious what you think. But this is obviously, you know, goes against everything we've thought about the most contagious disease and all this other stuff. And it gives a whole lot more credence to the Spanish flu being in it, the problems with the COVID vaccine, the ability of the government to scare everybody to death to maintain COVID by lowering our resistance. You know, all those other variables that come in so they get the vaccine, so they can keep COVID going. COVID's a business. COVID is the worst medical holocaustic marketing scheme I think ever created. But it hasn't
turned into one. But hasn't it seemed odd to people that the United States is not the most populous country on earth, yet the United States has the most COVID deaths.
Is
over a million, right? So that's where we get into that whole conversation, and we should make sure the audience understands that.
Yeah, feel free.
But sort of the symptom, the thing that should, you know, trigger you to know that something's odd here, something's off, is that the United States has a million people dead. And we're not the biggest country. So how does India, with multiple times the population. So keep in mind, the population of India and the population of China are within like 35 million of each other. The difference between China and India is California. That's it.
Hmm.
All right. So India's got 1.4 billion, you know, 1.4 billion. China's 1.44 billion. You know, they're off by 35 million people. It's almost identical. All right. So India has a little over half a million people. 525,000 people have died from COVID in India. And America's got twice that. But we have a quarter of their population.
Yeah.
So if we have a quarter of their a quarter of their population, but twice the deaths of India, so let's just stop there. Doesn't that require an explanation from our public health officials? India has four times the population of the United States and half the deaths. Let's stop right there. Dr. Fauci, Dr. Walensky, can you help us understand how that happened? Well, Dr. Birx is testifying right now with Jim Jordan.
Oh.
Right now, live.
Okay.
I was watching it in the green room. I was watching that in the green room. And thank you for taking out the brown M&Ms, by the way. I appreciate that. So Dr. Birx has said in the past that the United States takes a very liberal approach to mortality. And that's where we get to died with COVID or died from COVID.
Yep.
And this you can find on the CDC's page. And I cite these statistics rather frequently. The CDC says explicitly on their comorbidity tab on COVID, and it says that for 5% of the deaths, COVID-19 was the only thing on the death certificate. For 95% for the remaining people, on average, there were four comorbidities.
So if we take 5% of a million, that's 50,000, right?
Correct. Give or take.
My math's not that good, but
as
Jim Thorpe and Brian Artis and Judy Mikovits and everybody else has said, that 95% of the people could have been saved with early treatments. So 5% of 50,000 would be 2,500.
Well, I think the stuff I'm putting on the table kind of changes the rules, because what I'm saying is, if you assume the only virus is SARS-CoV-2,
right,
that's kind of the issue, is nobody's really been paying attention to comorbidity number one. So comorbidity number one is not obesity. It's not diabetes. It's influenza, PNI.
Right. I remember you mentioned that.
So,
PNI is pneumonia, influenza, and what's the N?
And, the word and. It's P,
oh, and.
Pneumonia,
so pneumonia,
and influenza. Right,
yeah.
Pneumonia and influenza. And this is a construct that the CDC came up with after the 2009 H1N1 outbreak. Mm-hmm. And this is where Dr. Judy was like so on top of this. She was like, oh, my God, I remember exactly what happened then. So the H1N1 swine flu outbreak of 2009. So the odd thing about that, only 12,000 people died, according to the CDC.
Mm-hmm. But this is why I brought up that number 2,500, because if you figure the people that actually died from COVID, and if we could have saved 95% of them with early treatments, only 2,500 people in the United States should have died from COVID.
Correct. Now we get to the other 950,000.
Well, that's a staggering figure. 2,500.
It is huge.
Well, it's huge because it's small. That's what makes it such a huge... You know, and just broadcast. There's news, folks. You want news? We just made news. Okay, 2,500 people should have died from COVID, according to their own information.
Yeah, the frustration that I think everybody had was, why are we not allowed to even talk about ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine or any of the combination?
Why.
Well, we know why is because if there was an alternative treatment, the vaccines don't get EUA.
Yep.
Right. And that's that's the 21 U.S. Code 360 BBB.
That's the basis of my bill, Dr. Zelenko. That's the basis of our bill.
Right.
Is to reform that. And what we said was, no, you can't do that. Well, actually, what we said was that EUAs could be issued by the president. EUAs could be issued by Congress.
you know, if Trump were president, we wrote this bill in August of 2020.
All right, so let's talk about this.
Trump
could have issued
an EUA for
it. This is huge. So you've got the bill, mm-hmm. and what I'm proposing right now, and again, I'm rather persistent, would be a nice way to put it, Twitter.
That's why you're here.
I'm like a dog with a bone. So the issue with the EUA is that they grant emergency use authorization for a product that can diagnose. All right, so that would be the PCR test. BioFire received EUA. Eplex received EUA to do PCR testing. Okay, so diagnosing, treating, that's your Paxlovid and Molnupiravir, right? So you got Paxlovid and Molnupiravir are your treatments, or to prevent the disease. That's the wording in 21 U.S. Code 360 BBB. It has to be either to diagnose, to treat, or to prevent the disease. Well, the problem that I think they are going to have right now is that the people who've had the inoculation, like Nancy Pelosi, it didn't prevent her from getting the disease. It didn't prevent Fauci from getting the disease. It didn't prevent Kamala Harris from getting the disease. It didn't prevent Susan Rice from getting the disease. It didn't prevent Xavier Becerra, the head of HHS, has had it twice now. Justin Trudeau has had it twice, right? Has had it twice.
Yeah.
So clearly, the inoculation does not prevent the disease. And if
that's
the case,
according to Judy, it spreads it.
Well, here's what I'm trying to establish. It's okay. Like the runner didn't touch first base. If the runner didn't touch first base, it doesn't matter what happened at third base. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
The runner didn't touch first base. If the inoculation doesn't prevent the disease, as evidenced by this list of people that have had it not just once but twice since being inoculated,
mm-hmm.
well, then it isn't the EUA null and void and invalid since it doesn't do that.
Yeah. Let me ask – I'm going to ask Jonathan that same question. I'll give him a chance to think about it. Jim, haven't heard from you yet. How are all these numbers sitting with you? 2,500 dead from COVID is what should have been. Vietnam not having any, China having 20,000. Jim.
Nah, it just wouldn't set the password. The 5G now.
Oh, you doing something in the background there?
I really am impressed with John Cullen and his world map and his figures. And I'm in 100% solidarity with him on those numbers. You know, you can also do it by state and by continent. You can look at Africa as the least vaccinated continent in the world, mm-hmm. and they have the least number of problems with morbidity and mortality with COVID.
How about that?
And then the same with the states in the United States of America. I think the large, we were told, the stakeholders told us so much misinformation that we were just overwhelmed. So much misinformation. You know, I think the large piece of misinformation that comes out now is that they really use fallacious markers for immunity. You know, the presence or absence of an antibody or T cells or B cells, they don't define immunity. They never did. And that's the problem with the pharmaceutical industry is they pick variables which they can address, or they can advertise as a golden diagnostic value for immunity, when in fact it is not at all. The presence or an absence of an antibody has nothing, really very little if any. You can have zero antibodies present and be completely immune, and vice versa.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, Jim? In my business,
ahead,
Jim, we call that measuring the wrong things. And so right? So the pharmaceutical companies on purpose will set it up so that the things that we're measuring not necessarily indicative of the outcomes that we're after, right? And so you mentioned Africa. I've got the numbers right in front of me right now live. Nigeria has fewer – so keep in mind Nigeria is the largest country in Africa. Over 200 million people live in Nigeria. Has fewer dead than Rhode Island, according to the official Johns Hopkins and the WHO. Nigeria has 3,144 people dead. Rhode Island has more than that. West Virginia has more than that.
Breaking up a little bit, John. I don't know if your mic, the gain's a little higher or something. We're just getting a little bit of a little breakup of your signal. Because if mine breaks up too, you got to let me know. I don't because I don't always know. Let me bring Jonathan in the conversation here. Just Jonathan's first time. Jonathan's our legal expert, has worked in Washington for a ton of years, knows bureaucracies, knows the problems. And let's get back to that question that John Cullen raised, which is on the EUAs. The EUAs obviously aren't working. They made illegal, de facto, the drugs that work, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, zinc, vitamin D3, vitamin C, in favor of these snake oil jabs that are killing people. And so does that not violate the EUA in terms of the section that that John just mentioned, which I have a bill for, section 360 BBB-3C, criteria for issuance of authorization. Jonathan?
Hey, you're talking to me. I'm in the middle of a service call from my landlord, but I was listening. I mean,
okay.
You know that the EUA and any other licensing has multiple aspects to it, including it has to prove effectiveness because everything, as Jim Coleman had, I mean, because everything has risk, right?
Right.
You know, my father was a doctor, and that doesn't make me a doctor, but I certainly heard a lot about it. The thing is that. You know, the body is the human body is complex and strange, and that means sometimes something that's safe for you might not be safe for me. So if there isn't a proof of effectiveness, then there can't be, you know, then like no risk is worth it. So the risk has to be balanced against the fact that it has to actually work. Otherwise, it's an unreasonable risk.
That makes sense.
And that sounds like what you got going there is that no matter how low the risk is, it's not worth it if it doesn't work.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. You know, I'm looking at some very interesting data, Patrick and John and Greg.
Patrick's not here yet. I'll let you know when he gets here. It's just you, Jonathan, and John Cullen.
Jonathan and John and Greg. So OpenVerus, as of today, we got 2.176 million reports of adverse effects through OpenVerus. And, you know, if you do a simple calculation and you look at about the number of vaccines that have been administered in the world. And I've done this past week, and I got a pretty good number, and it's pretty astounding. 11.39 billion shots. Billion. Now, we only have 7.5 billion on the planet, so obviously not everybody's vaccinated, but multiple individuals have gotten multiple shots. But if you think about that, you actually have a denominator from OpenVerus, and if we use OpenVerus numbers as of today, that constitutes a 1.9% risk of a significant adverse event. If you do the exact same with reported deaths in VAERS, gives you a 2.5% risk of death from the shot. If you look at the cases of myocarditis, pericarditis, there's 41,938 cases. And if you divide that by the number of shots, that gives you a 3.7% risk of myocarditis, pericarditis with a shot. If you look at permanent disability, there's 53,989. Divide that by your 11.39 billion shots. You get a 2.8% risk. Now, understand that I'm multiplying those open bears numbers by 100 because that's the underreporting factor.
Okay,
so
that makes
sense. If you're not following the math, that's integrated into these calculations. And then finally, the history, the reported severe bears allergic reactions, 41,674. And of course, toots a risk factor per injection of 3.7%. Nobody in their right mind would ever take a vaccination with those kinds of risks. I'm not. You can't quote me on the exact actual risk because these are estimates. But, you know, what's amazing, if you do simple chi-square analysis and you look at these risks are so statistically out there that the analytics are very robust. No matter what changes you make in the assumptions of the model, you still come up with, you know, yes, you can't hang your hat on the absolute percent risk of those events because it's coming from theirs. But it's pretty darn good. And, you know, all those events that I mentioned just in the last 18 months, those events, those horrible events, I'm talking about deaths, severe adverse events. We're talking about myocarditis, pericarditis, permanent disability from a vaccine injury, life-threatening adverse events, and severe adverse allergic reactions, severe. When you're looking at this, it is just unbelievable. You make as many assumptions as you want to throw at me for not believing the actual numbers. You change them, you still have the same results. And all of those results are far more in just 18 months of adverse reactions that we've had all vaccines in the last 30 years. All vaccines combined.
Well, here's the question, too. Do you have an overall, if you combine the myocarditis, the allergic reactions, the deaths, the injuries, all the different crippling things, the blood clots, the organs destroyed, what is the overall risk of having something adverse happen with a COVID shot? Has it ever been put together, either John or Jim?
No, because, you see, it in terms of the five categories that I just rattled off, some of those can
right.
be double represented in various
okay.
categories. So I think you can't simply do a mathematical sum.
Okay. So,
you know, about risks, you know, an acceptable risk is going to be, you know, 1 in a million, 10 in a million.
Okay.
Not 3 per 100, 4 per 100.
Yeah, 37 per 100. 3.7 is 37 people per 100. That's over a third. Or is it 1,000? 3.7.
Oh, geez.
My math is not. Anyway, it's still on. Well, here's my question. What's the risk from COVID?
Okay, that's first base. That's yeah.
Okay.
Back to first base.
Okay, John.
All right.
Zero.
Please continue.
Zero. Right. So this is, to me, this is sort of, again, this is like, did the runner touch first base? So
mm-hmm.
all this adverse reaction stuff that every, mm-hmm. you know, all the physicians are talking about, it's all valid. It's all true. I'm with it. You know, I get it. But I'm back at, did the runner touch first base?
Okay.
And so what do I mean by that? How many children – so this week was the week where, you know, they're taking another step forward with EUA authorization for children from 6 months to 5 years old.
Right.
So the fundamental question that you would ask in the world that I come from is, okay, we want to vaccinate them. Why? In order to prevent what? Is it to prevent them from contracting the disease? Is it to prevent them from dying? Is it both? Well, we know from Hugh Jackman and Maxine Waters and Xavier Becerra that people who've been inoculated still contract the virus and contract it twice in mm-hmm. in the case of all the people I just mentioned. So it doesn't prevent people from contracting the virus. So it can't be used for that. So that would mean it's being used to prevent children from dying. Well, how many children are dying from COVID? And how does that compare to deaths from other causes? In other words, is COVID the leading killer of children? Is this the biggest issue that we see right now is COVID? And this is, again, people have talked about this mass, you know, group hypnosis, mass psychosis, whatever they call it. I call it group hypnosis. The fundamental question is, how many children died with COVID? Because if the answer was, so this is another tool that we use in my industry, Jim. It's called the logical absurd. And the logical absurd is, in order for a model to work, it has to really work at both ends of the spectrum that are somewhat absurd. Okay, so the logical absurd would be, well, if no children died from COVID at all, would we still inoculate them? And the answer to that would be probably not.
Yeah.
Right? If no children died from COVID, zero, we probably wouldn't inoculate them, right? So then using the logical absurd, it's like calculus. So in calculus, we have a multivariable equation. And what you learn in high school and to solve that is you graph it and you chart it out, right? So same thing, we're going to do the same thing with this logical absurd. If one child died, would we inoculate all 60 million children in the United States? If one child died from COVID?
Probably not.
Still, the answer is probably not. Now, I want to take the logical absurd all the way to the other end of the spectrum. Okay? What if in April of 2020, it was clear one out of three kids is going to die from COVID? Now, had that been the case, the risks that we might have been willing to accept if one in three kids was dying of COVID, the risk, you have to factor this in.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, myocarditis in 3 out of 100 kids might have been an acceptable risk if 34% of the children were dying of COVID. Now, that's the logical absurd. But you have to factor this in to the decision-making to understand where you really are sitting, and it's somewhere in between that. So the question is, well, how many children died? Well, before I answer that, I want to pose to the audience a question that you're going to find somewhat stunning. Again, I tweeted this out on Twitter at @I_M_JohnCullen earlier today. How many people in the United States that died with COVID were under 40 years old versus over as a percentage? Now, keep in mind that the life expectancy in the United States for women is 81 years old. The life expectancy for men is 77. And I'm asking you to give me the over-under percentage, people under 40 that died with COVID versus people over 40. What is the percentage?
And the answer is? We sit here waiting with bated breath.
Anybody want to take a guess?
Well, I got them muted because we had some background noise. So if you're not talking and if you have any background noise, I don't, you know, you always want to mute line. That way it'll keep it from doing so. Let's bring Jonathan back on. Let's bring Jin on. Let's bring Brian Artis, who's joining the conversation here. Let's take an order. Jonathan, Jim, and Brian. Jonathan,
under 40, older than 40. What's the percentage breakdown?
Jonathan, you want to try a guess at this?
No, I don't. I mean, it's overwhelmingly over 40, but I don't remember the numbers.
Yeah, I want to get back to you on the legal question of the EUAs in a little bit. But anyway, Jim, you want to take a guess? This is more your department.
I mean, it clearly it's very much lower than over 40, and the children that are dying is extremely rare. In fact, one can make a strong argument that there's never been a child that's died of a COVID that was otherwise healthy.
Well, that's interesting. So we're vaccinating people. We're dangerously vaccinating people for something that they're not going to die of or get sick from.
The pointed part of it, and this is what makes people so uncomfortable, is when you're faced with the actual data from the CDC, everybody's like, well, why? How do we not know this? Who was keeping this from us? So here's the data. This is from cdc.gov. from their sex and age tab on COVID deaths, and this is mortality, and this was updated yesterday. People under 40 represent...
Well, I haven't guessed yet. I was going to say 10% under 40, 90% over 40. That's what I would guess.
That's a good guess. All right, so 10%. So that would mean 100,000 people under 40 and 900,000 people were in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and older.
Right.
That's a pretty good guess. Dr. Brian, do you want to take a crack at this, or what do you think of Greg's guess? What do you think of Greg's 90-10 split?
What do I think of a 90? Let's see. Ask me again what that percentage is for those under 40 and over 40.
So what Greg is proposing is 10% of the deaths were under 40. So that'd be about 100,000 people. And 90% of the deaths were over 40.
All right, so I'm going to guess that it's 3% or less under 40.
Brian Artis, you move to the bonus round. Congratulations.
Well, he's a doctor. Yeah, I'm just a talk show host. Jeez, pick on me.
So here's the number. So the number's 2.49%, less than 2.5% were under 40. 25,700 people died with COVID. Now you take your comorbidity factor, which is 5%.
Uh-huh. Right.
So 5% of that number, it's about 12, 13, 1,400 people, somewhere in that range, are people that died exclusively from SARS-CoV-2, the virus.
Under 40?
Under 40, that didn't have four comorbidities on average. Now, this is according to the CDC. They're the ones giving us averages. So that's what we use, right? But the number of people that died, that's explicit. They give you a count.
Yeah.
And the count is 25,700. Brian Artis, right on the money. 2.49% under 40. 97.5% of the COVID deaths are people over 40. So we're not even at children. Now let me tell you about children. One of the worst states as far as just the total number of deaths is Florida. Florida has over 70,000 people that died with COVID.
Is that age-related?
No, so that's everybody. 70,478 people died in Florida so far as of this past week. That's all ages. Now, of those 70,478 people that died, how many of those were school-aged kids between 5 and 17.
Three.
Died with COVID, it's 55.
Okay.
Now, 55 is 0.0779%. It's not even 0.08%. So it's less than 0.1% by a bit. Under 5 years old, 27 kids. Out of 70,000 deaths, 70,478, 27 were under 5 years old. And we want to inoculate all of the children under five in Florida because 27 of them died with COVID.
Not from COVID. This is just with COVID.
Correct. Correct. So to me, all of the vaccine injury, vaccine safety, efficacy, vaccine impact stuff, that's second base and third base. To me, what I'm describing here is, what do we need it for? Did the runner touch first base? Have we even established that there is a need to inoculate children If 27 kids under 5 died with COVID, how many of those kids had cystic fibrosis?
Okay, now wait a minute. Let's apply the action radio factor, the 5%, because 95% we're figuring could have been saved by early treatments. So let's take 5% of your 27,000. That's 2,700. That's what's half of 27. That's 26 is 13. So we're talking about 1,200 kids or 1,200 people under 40?
Well, under 40. I was just talking about in Florida alone.
So let's talk about the five-year-old kids. So how many kids died at 5 or less?
All right. Well, here, let me give you in Florida, 27 kids were under 5.
Kids. All right. So 27
out of
kids,
70,000
right?
deaths. And we want to inoculate all the kids because 27 died? More kids drowned. More kids drowned.
Go ahead, Jim.
Of the 27 kids, John, right. How many of them had zero comorbidities?
According to the CDC, they only give you an average, so they don't tell you by state, and they don't get that, so they tell you on average 5% of the 27, so that's one kid. That's one child died with COVID under 5. The other 25 or 6 kids had, on average, 4 comorbidities according to the CDC. So this is what their website says. And that's why I repeat it over and over, because I don't want to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. I use their definitions. So they're telling us 5% of the death certificates say just COVID-19.
So anybody think we could save that one kid with early treatment?
Well, that one kid died with COVID. Right. If that kid had had, you know, a pediatric dose of ivermectin, maybe, right? If there had
this
been
is the
some...
thing. That's the action radio factor. The 5% of people would die. 95% could be saved. So if you figure,
I get it.
So you had 95%.
I'm talking about vaccines. I get it.
Yeah.
I'm talking about vaccines. My
question is,
why do we need to vaccinate all the children in Florida that are under 5 years old if 27 of them died with COVID, 25 of the 27 had a whole bunch of comorbidities like cystic fibrosis and other afflictions? So to me, the risk of the vaccine, as soon as you introduce one risk, it's too many.
Yeah.
So we've got a bevy of them, and the question is, what are you inoculating the children for? What are you trying to prevent? Are you trying to prevent them from getting infected? Because it doesn't do that. Are you trying to prevent them from dying? So if you look at the whole country, the entire United States, birth to 17, all the children, everybody under 18, 1.3% died with COVID. 98.7% of the children, birth to 17, died from other causes. So Dr. Thorpe, this is all the stuff that's killing kids. 81,500 kids, birth to 17, died since January of 2020, since COVID's pretty much arrived and they started tracking COVID. So pulling the Wonder data from January 2020 for all-cause mortality in children 0 to 17. All deaths, 81,500. Deaths from COVID, 1,086, or 1.3% of the total. That tells me COVID is not the big killer of kids. Kids are dying from other things. If COVID's only accounting for 1.3%, and of those 1,086, we apply Greg's 5% factor, and what that means is it's really about 50-55 kids that died exclusively
saved.
With SARS-CoV-2. Right.
Yeah.
So 5%
of those 55, you could have saved 95% of them.
Right.
Anyway,
but why do we want to inoculate 60 million kids? If 1,000 have died with COVID,
that's the
justification isn't there.
It's irrational. Let's get Jonathan. Tell me about the DC view, the bureaucratic view, the investment portfolio view from Pfizer's perspective, because that's what we're really talking about here. Jonathan, help us out.
Oh my gosh, you're giving me a big. I can't get in people's heads, but
you should be used to it.
Been
here before.
But I mean, clearly something happened in this topic that is unlike anything we've ever done before. That has to be recognized. Yes, you could say that, you know, DC runs on terror of a headline in the New York Times or something like that, rather than mm-hmm. any logical thing. So avoiding any negative comment, you know, would be a theory, but it still doesn't explain why nothing in our history has been handled way before. So there's clearly an ulterior motive. You know, it's one of the things that they say in the law, and most judges and lawyers don't understand it, is if a decision cannot be explained by a rational, in fact, I was taught in the idea of the insane jury test, which is that if the jury, you know, on the evidence given would have to be nuts to convict the person, then the judge may overturn it. That doesn't mean that the jury is in fact nuts. It means they're motivated by something else. There's something, you know, if you cannot explain something based on its purported reasons, then there's some other reason lurking around that they're not admitting. And so here it seems like you cannot explain any of this based on the claimed reasons. Therefore, there must be hidden reasons for all of this. And it would seem to be, profit and in a lot of ways. So I mean, we've all talked about this on the show a lot, but the other thing too is it's amazing how the bureaucracy and the political class managed to operate with such unanimity and such lockstep. That is pretty strange. I mean, you can't get people to agree.
That's the other
anything,
unanswered question. Yet. Yeah, that's the other big unanswered question. Yeah, for those who are new, and for I'm going to bring Ben Marble on in a second. He's on, and Brian, we're going to get to introduce themselves. Jonathan's our legal expert at Action Radio, and it's just an invaluable resource. And so hopefully he'll be able to join us a lot more often. But now you can see why. Jim, did you have a comment for Jonathan? Jim?
Yeah, Jonathan. So you're absolutely right. In our manuscript earlier this year, entitled Patient Betrayal, the Corruption of Healthcare, Informed Consent and Physician-Patient Relationship, published in a peer-reviewed medical journal, Gazette of Medical Sciences, authored by 19 of us, including four well-known experienced attorneys. And we go through the whole issue that you just touched upon. The fact that there were probably well over 200, quote, governing bodies of medicine that simultaneously within 1 month of September 2021 came out with the identical language and threat to every physician and nurse in the United States of America that consisted of, quote, COVID misinformation, end quote, will get you destroyed. We will remove your credentials, possibly your licensure, and possibly destroy your family and your career. That's a matter of fact. And I think that, Jonathan, what you alluded to earlier was the fact that, over the last 100 years, you know, these folks that are invested, the administrators, the bureaucrats of these institutions, they're not physicians. They're not clinicians. If they are physicians, they have zero clinical experience. And they can no more agree on two words, let alone a whole threat. It takes years and years for them to agree on any language. And the fact that all of these institutions would come down with the exact same verbiage at the exact same time really is pretty solid suspicion of collusion, fraud, and RICO violation. And we go through that in Patient Betrayal Manuscript. And we address
the Is that a book, Jim, or is it the basis of a lawsuit?
No,
or what are you doing with it?
It's a peer-reviewed publication that we published earlier this year.
Jonathan, can you use that? Can we get a class action or some kind of suit or investigation? Or maybe I want to bring Larry Klayman into this, who started Judicial Watch. And then I want to get to Brian and Ben. So don't feel left out. I'm going to get to you. I just want to
we're sort of on topic here.
Jonathan?
We can, of course. But, you know, like every other area of society, as I've mentioned, you know, we've come to expect that there are certain institutions you can trust. And people have always felt like, oh, I'm going to sue. And then they discover that through the indoctrination of lawyers, which is admitted, you know, by the socialists starting in 1930 and stuff, that the courts aren't going to help them either. You know, the courts are filled with people. I mean, it's like they say about a corporation. Corporations cannot do anything without the people holding offices. And the courts, whatever we might have thought of them in the past, are just filled with people. And the people have been indoctrinated the same way as all these other people through high school, college, law school, you know, left-wing law firms,
judgeships, Supreme Court judges.
So they're not necessarily going to, you know, ride to our rescue and be the white knights that people want to believe they'll be. But yes, it technically should work that, starting with, you know, getting the documents, because and Judicial Watch does a relatively good job of that. Larry Klayman, who founded it but then left, you know, he complains that they go after documents, but then they don't follow through in terms of hardcore lawsuits. I assume from what we've heard about Dr. Fauci from Judy Mikovits from the 1980s.
Mm-hmm. She's usually on the show. She's flying right now, so she had to miss this time too. But she'll probably test me stuff with a bunch of obscenities I can't tell you. But Judy has some pretty colorful language.
And Larry Klayman had me, you know, work with her to develop an affidavit in his lawsuit against China. And, you know, I would assume from everything I'm seeing and from what Dr. Judy describes, that the phones were burning up. This unanimity was largely orchestrated, and you know it was. And remember that Dr. Fauci does not have the official authority. He's just one head of one part of the NIH. Mm. He's not even at the Centers for Disease Control. But he's always arrogated to himself the authority to tell everybody what to do back to the 80s. And so the thing is I would imagine that if we could see all the documents, if they still exist, and if it was in writing, we would see a pretty clear picture emanating from Dr. Fauci's office and through everybody else. And, you know, maybe the threat of withholding grants and things like that.
He had the pandemic playbook that Obama gave him. He actually gave it to Trump. Trump didn't want it, so she picked it up. And we call him Dr. Fascist around here most of the time. But what happened was he picked it up, that the whole White House Coronavirus Task Force was an Obama pandemic playbook thing, changing the guidelines from the 2007, you know, from the pandemic severity index to the instant lockdown of the 2017 guidelines 3 months after Trump took office. That's all part of the plan. I mean, I believe this is easily documented, but the question is getting the documents and doing something about it. So let me ask you just one more question before I get to Brian and Ben, is back to the emergency use authorizations. The fact that, as John Collins says, they don't work. He can prove they don't work. He can prove that the statistics, that the analysis of getting the jab, the snake oil, is far more dangerous in orders of magnitude above COVID itself. Can we use that to overturn these emergency use authorizations and get back to the drugs that work? Big question, I know. Jonathan, what do you think? I think he's thinking.
I don't understand.
Okay, can we take the fact that the COVID vaccines do not work as intended, use that? In fact, they're far more dangerous than they're purported to be. Can we, and the fact that COVID itself isn't that dangerous, based on John's figures, John Collins, can we use that to overturn these emergency use authorizations somehow? Be it congressional, judicial, or what?
In theory, yeah. I mean, if you could find an honest judge, remember the what was it? The was it a poem or the Greek mythology of someone wandering the earth with a lantern looking for an honest man? If you could find a careful and honest judge who wouldn't be looking over his or her shoulder, they should be stricken down. And you know, under the APA and the Administrative Procedures Act, and the fact that they're not justified, it would be good to have as much of the documentation as possible. I mean, mm-hmm. if you have, and I'm sure it at one point existed, you know, the communication saying, we want you to do this from Fauci or other people, clearly shows that it wasn't based on the science. You know, if you have records saying, yeah, we know we don't have the science, but do it anyway, or anything along those lines, anything, whatever, that would itself completely invalidate the proper process. That would show that the process is not, you know, was not valid because it was based on something other than
that's the Administrative Procedures Act, right? Administrative Procedures Act?
The Administrative Procedures Act is based on this myth that just like the Soviets and the Nazis and everybody else and FDR that we're doing pure science and the expert, we can't let politics have any role because the bureaucrats, you know, they are these pure halo wearing scientists and things like that. So it is very much the legality of all these things is very much premised on the idea that there's evidence and that the bureaucrats are following the evidence. If you have documentation,
which we know isn't true, they're making it up.
Right.
Yeah.
And the more evidence you have of that, the more evidence you have that it's legally invalid. And the EU, all of the regulations and things like that should be.
Okay. So what y'all need to do is get Jonathan on your panels, on your medical panels, on your interview shows, and let's put together a little coalition here of John's data, Jonathan's legal knowledge, all the rest of the doctors who are doing things, Brian Artis's TV show, and let's start talking about that. Let's start talking about the fact that these EAs are valid. And if nothing else, get it in the public debate. So let's go to Brian. Brian Artis, why don't you enter and sign in, please? A couple sentences on you, and then I'll get to Dr. Ben Marble. Brian? Unmute. Enter and sign in, please, unless you're busy. Going once, going twice? Ah, he must be doing something. Ben, why don't you enter and sign in, please, a couple sentences on yourself and what you think of everything so
sure.
far, then I'll let you folks all talk to each other. Ben?
Hello, can you hear me? Me, Greg?
You're doing just fine. Yep, gotcha live.
All right, this is Ben Marble. I'm the founder of MyFreeDoctor.com. We've delivered over 250,000 free doctor visits to America. And have a 99.99% survival rate with multiple drug early treatments. Basically, we've settled the science. We have clearly proven multiple drug early treatment works. And, of course, we know that the C19 fake vaccine gene editing poison only works to kill people. So certainly enjoying the conversation, just listening. And, a year ago, just looking at some videos I made a year ago, I made a video calling for the immediate banning of all COVID-19 vaccines because we know they're poison. All the, the VAERS data started coming in. We started these vaccines in December 2020. They're not real vaccines. They're fake vaccines. By the end of January, I was getting feedback from patients that, this person had a stroke. This other person had a heart attack. This person had a pulmonary embolus. So I started hearing the horror stories pretty early on and knew that they were poisonous. And a year ago, June 2021, I made a video saying we need an immediate ban. A year later, we've now given over 5 billion people have received this poison. It's the greatest mass poison in the history of the world, which is why the mass die-off is just starting. So I think it's a rather bleak picture. When you look at the big picture, what's going on, the PC commies are in control. They're ignoring all the rules. They're ignoring all the laws. And that's the problem. When they're in charge of all the alphabet organizations that make these decisions and the leadership is corrupt and they refuse to follow their own rules, you look at the data at Open VAERS, where approaching 30,000 official deaths from CDC, which even with their numbers, that's more than all real vaccines combined in four decades. So it's the most deadly vaccine of all time. So it's how they can claim the most deadly vaccine of all time is quote unquote safe and effective boggles my mind. Of course, it's not safe and effective. We know it's not. It's actually what we're going to find out is these COVID vaccines, the C-19 fake vaccines, are going to go down in history as the single most deadly poison of all time, more deadly than arsenic, more deadly than cyanide. And the reason why is because we've given, you know, we don't go around giving people cyanide and arsenic, yet we're going around giving them a poison that's just as bad and going to kill way more people than cyanide or arsenic ever killed. And that's sort of my big picture, summation
no,
of what's
it's,
going
it's,
on right now.
It's bleak, but it's accurate. And so my question always is, you know, being Action Radio, what do we do about it? And so, Jonathan, is there a way to take this? Is there a way to get an – you know, remember the judge in Florida that overturned the mask mandate? Is that someone who might be open to overturning the EUA and putting an injunction on the emergency authorization of all of these COVID shots? Could a judge do that? Jonathan?
Greg?
Yeah, Jim? Yeah, go ahead.
So for Jonathan, but what I can tell you is I'm officially on record publicly and, you know, this week with all of my analytics from multiple different sources of proclaiming a worldwide ban and moratorium on the use of any of the genetic therapies in pregnancy. Pregnancy is my area of expertise. That's what I've been doing. That's what I was born. That's what God created me to do. I've been doing it. I've seen a lot. I've seen a lot of disasters in my specialty, thalidomide being one, DES being another, the Dalkon Shield. The poison jab is going to make all of those prior disasters in my specialty look like children's play, look like the perpetrator, look like altar boys. And it's going to make those two drugs look like prenatal vitamins. This is the greatest disaster in the history of obstetrics. And this is why there's not anybody in the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the Federation of State Medical Boards, American Board of Medical Specialties, there's nobody in these organizations that are real docs. They're really just administrators. If they do have an MD on their name, they don't see patients. They probably haven't seen patients for the vast majority of their career, like Fauci. So they have broken the golden rule of pregnancy that God has ordained and has written on every single human being's heart. Doesn't matter whether you're an MD, whether you're a college graduate, whether you're a high school graduate, whether you're a grade school graduate, we all know as physicians and as citizens of the world that you never, ever use a novel experimental drug or vaccine in pregnancy. There was zero safety data. So that is where I believe a judge for sure, at least in my specialty, should and I believe will proclaim a ban on the worldwide use of the, quote, vaccine, end quote, in pregnancy. Should never have been used. The stakeholders badly misrepresented and suggested that there was safety data in pregnancy. There never was. Don't ever take this fake poison vaccine in pregnancy. It's extremely dangerous. I've seen horrible losses. I see 6 to 7. I'm on par now this year of seeing 8,000 high-risk ODs a year. I'm telling you, I've been doing this for 42 years. I am willing to debate anybody at the American College of OBGYN, anybody at the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology, anybody in the Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine, which I held a board position on for 4 years. Come on, debate me. Tell me how you have decided that you are smarter than the conventional wisdom
that God gave us for 6,000 years. And let's debate it in Congress. Let's debate it in the Senate with Dr. McCullough, you know, Dr. Pierre Corey, and myself, and Senator Ron Johnson. Let's do that. Will you come to the table and debate us, bureaucrats and constituents in these NGO governmental organizations that have put a gag order on every position in the United States of America?
Well, you make some excellent points. I don't want to debate Senator Johnson. I want to work with him. I want to include him. I want to get him our vaccine product liability bill, which will shut Pfizer down in seconds because they're not going to take the risk. They're only doing this because there is no risk. It's like a gambler who keeps the winnings, but the losses are covered. There's no risk. Same thing with our information bill, Section 230 corrections, in like five lines of law. We put make the liability immunity on big tech conditional that they don't touch anything anybody says or their accounts or the arrangements of the search engines. These are monumental bills. These two bills by themselves could change everything in terms of this whole debate. So that's why I say we've got the information. We know what the problem is. I mean, each of you are experts in what the problems are. Dr. Ben Marble is an expert in early treatments. Jim Tharp, an expert on pregnancy. I mean, each of you have your own specialties. But we need to get you together, and we need to find out, you know, if we're going to do talk about a moratorium, we need a donor. We need like our version of George Soros. We need some people to get together and put forward a worldwide advertising campaign. I mean, I made a PSA for COVID, but that just covers my show. You know, it hasn't been shared widely around the world. Yeah, I mean, it's YouTube. Why didn't it go viral? We need the information out there. And one of the ways I want to try and, you know, have an impact is to get Jonathan and the legal world involved with the medical world, because we have to partner up. We have to get together and start doing this. So
listening to what Dr. Tharp is describing with pregnancy.
Yep.
I'm sure all of us listening and here on the show are in violent agreement.
Oh, absolutely.
That needs to happen. That's a valid approach. And it almost got me thinking like Air Force, Marines, Navy, Army. Like that is an approach in and of itself with stands by it, you know, stands on its own, can be validated easily. He's willing to debate anybody who wants to debate it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that should be pursued. At the same time, we have a couple other fronts that we can also approach them on. In other words, we don't need one full frontal attack. If there are multiple points of attack on this EUA, one of which Dr. Tharp is describing, right? Another one, and this whole bevy of vaccine injuries outside of the female reproductive system, right? Mm-hmm. Dr. Marble, Dr. Artis, you know all about that stuff. And I'm simply asking, do we need to vaccinate the kids at all in the first place? What is the need? How many kids need to die where you guys want to inoculate the entire population of 60 million kids?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think any of the people, Dr. Tharp, that you're talking about, I don't think they can cite how many kids have died in their own state. They don't know how many school-age kids have died. They don't know.
Well, nobody's asked them. People aren't asking them. That's the problem.
So why would you want to inoculate them all if you don't know how many have died?
Who wants that? Anybody want to jump in?
I would say the answer why is because the poison cult, PC poison cult, those people who are captured by the brainwashing, which is the most successful brainwashing in human history, those who are captured by it ignore common sense, and they want to keep taking the poison. They're all insane, and how you know they're insane? The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. These are the people that will line up for booster after booster after booster after booster, expecting a different result, even though we know the shots do not prevent COVID and do make you sick. So we're dealing with a bunch of insane people, and if you expect sane outcomes out of insane people, then you're also insane. So this is the problem. The global mass psychosis has captured over half the planet, you know, over 5 billion people poisoned already. So, you know, we've been fighting this for a year and a half. See, Some people think that this is just starting, like, but we've been preaching about this for a year and a half, and they just ignore all the facts. They ignore all the science. They ignore the reality of it all. So,
to me, the gorilla in the room fact, the gorilla in the room fact, to me, and again, I'm a bit different from you guys, right? I'm not neurotypical. So to me, it's numbers are how I see all this stuff. So when I look at California, right, gorgeous, what's his name, Gavin Newsom, right, talking about him running for president. Okay. 95,600 people have died in California. That's three times Japan, okay? 95,000 people died. How many school-aged kids between 5 and 17 have died from COVID since the beginning of the pandemic in California? Of the 95,637 people that have died in gorgeous Gavin Newsom's California, how many were school-aged kids between 5 and 17 that they're talking about inoculating all of them? How many died? Nobody knows the number. And yet, they want to inoculate all. It's like, wouldn't the number be a factor here? If the answer was 2, wouldn't they feel a little silly? So doesn't
don't wait to be called up, folks. Just having a conversation at this point. You all know each other. Just jump
in. To me, this number matters more than anything else. Because if you want to invalidate the EUA, you invalidate it. There's no need. What is the pediatric medical emergency if blank number of school-aged children died in California out of 95,600 deaths? What is the number? And do any of you guys want to take a stab at how many school-aged children between 5 and 17 died in California?
I would bet that number's less than 5. Probably close to 0.
From all causes?
Without any comorbidities, zero comorbidity, COVID only, I would bet that number's close to 0, if not 0.
John?
But the reality is facts don't matter. We're dealing with insane people, and they don't care about the reality of it. And there is no justification for the mass poisoning because we're dealing with insane people.
No. Hang on. You can't say facts don't matter. And we're talking about the public.
Facts don't matter to them. The people that are in control do not care about the facts. It's all about the agenda, right? The power, the destruction of America on purpose.
All right, but I'm talking about the public. I think the people listening to the show right now have no idea how many school-age kids are dead. And if they knew that, if this was on the news, if this was covered by mainstream media, and the news came out and said, hey, this is how many kids have died, school-age kids in California, I think many more parents would take a step back and say, what? Are you kidding me? Of the 95,637 people that died in California, this many were school-age kids between 5 and 17? The point is nobody knows the answer. And that lack of clarity is pivotal, because if you don't – why do you need an EUA if you don't know how many kids are dying? What do you need to inoculate them for? It's clear that the inoculation does not prevent the disease. At this point, you know, the vice president has been inoculated and had the disease, so it doesn't prevent the disease. That's they can't even debate that. So then it has to be to prevent death.
Well, can I ask the straight man dumb questions?
Yeah.
If you have, other than times past where people lived in their villages and didn't travel much, but we have international travel. Is there any such thing as preventing infection worldwide? I mean, if given enough time with modern travel, is my, you know, gut level feeling that eventually the virus will hit everybody? Is that a reasonable point of view?
That's what the data shows. That's what the maps show. Yeah, the maps are showing that now. Places like Taiwan and New Zealand that previously had a couple hundred people dead now are in the thousands. So they were able to keep it at bay for a couple of years. But now you're seeing, in fact, Taiwan has the second most cases in the last 4 weeks of any country on Earth. Second, of course, to the United States.
But I'm also trying to direct it to your question, which is the goal to stop death or serious injury, or is it to stop infection if stopping infection is impossible?
Well, according to the wording, if we go to 21 U.S. Code 360 BBB, it says that the product has to either diagnose, treat, or prevent the disease. That's the language they use. So we know it doesn't diagnose it, and you can't say that Spikevax and Comirnaty are treatments. They're not. They're inoculations, and so it's there to prevent the disease. And we know from this list of people that have contracted it doesn't prevent the disease. So you have that fundamental element. And then the second fundamental element is how many kids died that you think there's a pediatric medical emergency, that you want to inoculate kids 6 months old? How many kids died in your state? And nobody knows the answer, yet they're ready to go inoculate them all.
Let me ask you another question, just to throw more into the mill here. Do you have maps that are pre-COVID vaccine and post-COVID vaccine? In other words, nations that had no COVID, like Vietnam, if they got the jab, what did the rate go to? So what are the pre- and post rates for some representative nations? That would be instructive.
So there's a couple of standouts, one of which is Vietnam. So Vietnam is one of them. Another one would be Taiwan. Another one would be Thailand.
The nations you said just had the most recent problems. Well, this is fascinating. That's why I asked the question.
So when you look at Vietnam, for well over a year, Vietnam, the second largest country in Southeast Asia, next to China, 100 million people. There were less than 500 people dead in Vietnam until they started their inoculation program. Today,
why did they do it if they didn't have anybody dying? That's my next question.
Because this gets into the stuff that the other doctors are talking about. There's this global cadre of lunatics that are basically selling vaccines, and there are certain
don't need them. Hence, there's snake oil. selling stuff that people don't need.
No, but it's serious. Like in Tanzania, he said, get the hell out of here. I'm not buying $5 billion worth of vaccines. Get the hell out of here. And 30 days later, he died.
Yeah, about that. He passed away.
A heart attack. It's a heart attack. That's our standard operating.
Is it to engineer a heart attack?
Ask any nurse. They'll tell you.
Okay. He's not the only one. We talked about this before. The Jamaica wasn't the, and there was another person. There's three people have died after rejecting COVID vaccines.
If you don't buy the amount of vaccines that this group wants you to buy, I'm not sure how long you're going to. Yeah, a bunch of them are gone. I mean, that's certainly spooky. But again,
we need that list.
If the fundamental assumptions of the EUA are that A, it prevents infection, and B, if there's any form of a pediatric emergency or, Dr. Thorpe, what would you call it when a woman is pregnant? We have pediatric medical emergencies. What would you call it during pregnancy? If there's a medical emergency during pregnancy, what do you call that?
Obstetrical emergency.
Yeah, so there's no evidence that there is an obstetric medical emergency. Zero. And yet they're going to take on all of this unknown risk. This is, I think, how we can chip away at this EUA. So it doesn't have a leg to stand on. I think we've got a couple different fronts that we can attack. But Jonathan,
you just stated it.
There
is no emergency. You can't have an emergency use authorization when there's no emergency. I think you've just summed up the lawsuit.
Well, how many school-age children out of the 95,000 would constitute an emergency? How many would need to die, right? How many school-age kids, 5 to 17, out of the 95,600 people in California only, I'm talking about. This is just gorgeous Gavin Newsom, right? Because he's going to be the next president, right? So gorgeous Gavin Newsom, California, 95,000 dead, three times Japan, right? Four times China. He's got four times more dead than China, all right? How many school-age kids need to die in his state for that to be a medical emergency? What's a good number?
I'm going to bring up the old 2000.
Well, I would say here's
people are guessing.
Can I interject?
Yeah, go, please.
The problem with this, I would say the problem with this logic is that, yes, there is no emergency. We all know that. But
how do you know
time,
it? I have to, well, how do
well,
you know?
I'm getting, to a specific point. I have a very simple point to make. At the when there's more people dying than ever, and the mass die-off is in progress, then arguing there's no emergency is actually false because there is an emergency. It's just a different emergency than the one that granted the EUA. There is an emergency. All the people are dropping dead from the poison. So that's how they justified the emergency because look, all the people are dying because there are. More people dying right now than have ever died in human history because of the mass poisoning. So that's the catch-22 of it.
All right. But, I'm trying to chop at the root of the tree, which is there is no pediatric medical emergency to grant the authorization for the vaccine. If we chop it down there, no, the vaccine can't be used. There is no EUA.
We've been arguing that point for a year and a half now on all these fronts. We've argued about not giving it to children. Oh,
with all
certainly
respect,
we have. Just because you weren't in the conversation doesn't mean we haven't been arguing that point.
With all due respect, what you haven't done, with all due respect, you haven't been able to cite how many kids died so that you guys want to vaccinate them all. You can't challenge them with that question if you don't know the answer, right? So of the 95,000 people that died, if we don't know the answer, how many kids died? Why do you want to vaccinate them? I'm telling you there's no rationale for vaccinating the kids at all. Zero.
I've been saying the same thing for over a year. Nobody wants to vaccinate
the
children.
But I have the data.
Data is not going to solve this. Court cases are not going to solve this.
I disagree with you.
I do too.
I respect you.
Year and a half, we've been sounding the alarm. They ignore all the alarms.
Ben, I love what you do. Don't get me wrong. I have nothing but respect for you. But I think in this case,
I would say part of the problem is the politicians are always 6 months behind the curve. They wave their finger in the air and they take an opinion poll. And so expecting politicians to rescue us, I expect us to rescue us,
but we use the politicians. I created Action Radio so that we would write the bills that Congress wouldn't, you know, and Jonathan, you know, went into law to be able to do things to protect people in ways that weren't being able to be done. John's got the data, and we can use that data and the legal system. I think we can use it. I think we want to give up on it yet. But I want to give John Cullen.
We should certainly
try,
but so far we have failed miserably.
Well, I mean, I haven't gotten a bill passed either. It doesn't mean I stopped trying. I've got two incredible bills that the more that you folks, quite honestly, every panel that you're on, every time you're before, you know, Senator Johnson, anytime you're on any committee or advisory or media or anything, if you talk about those two bills are going to become part of the national debate, and that will change everything. If you don't, in the same way that you're wanting to have, you think that the court cases aren't going to get anywhere because they haven't been tried. In the same way, my citizen legislation that I've written, the bill I wrote with Dr. Zelenko, you know, on the EUA of different ways to do it. You know, the reason that's not going anywhere is because not everybody's talking about it. So I know exactly how you feel because I feel it the same way for what I'm trying to do. So I'm there with you. But we need to help each other, and we need to work on each other's causes. We need the legal angle. We need the political angle. We need the media angle. We need all these things working together. But I want to do something for John Cullen.
I think
what's actually going to result in
getting the poison ban is time. Because now that we've started poisoning the fake Fauci doctors and nurses have started poisoning little babies, it's easy to predict what's going to happen. And lots of babies across the world are going to start dying. And then when parents connect the dots, grieving parents are going to deliver justice And once those faked out, the doctors and nurses realize that their own life is on the line, they're going to stop giving people poison.
Yeah. Does anybody know Dinesh D'Souza? I mean, know the impact of 2,000 mules, right? So if we get the same thing. Okay, so if you know Dinesh D'Souza, literally, let's get him here. Let's propose his next movie. And this should be it. There is no emergency. I'm serious. Who knows him, Jim?
That's fine. That's fine, except like you know, there are two aspects that I want to focus on. One is that we have become a narcissistic, if it feels good, do it. My opinion is as good as your opinion. Society where, you know, basically, in my view, science is dead. It's all about emotion. And so we're trying to, like, you know, debate on the head of a pin what is wrong with, you know, with our approach. And there's basically nothing wrong with their approach. We're talking to people who aren't speaking the same language. It's like you're talking to, you know, aliens who don't speak the language of logic or science or facts or evidence.
Bingo.
And the other, the problem is that there's just so much to fight. I assume that Dinesh D'Souza is nowhere near done on this topic. He's going to, you know, keep rolling out issues of this. So, you know, from 2,000 mules is, you know, I think is probably the opening salvo. So if you could get him to the point of saying, okay, you're done now, you know, what do you want to do next? I think it makes sense. It's a big issue and things like that. So
we need the exposure. So, you know, we've got the bills. You've got the evidence. I mean, John can provide the evidence to you for the lawsuits, to the folks that could bring it to a judge and possibly get an injunction. We've got all that. We just don't have the public support because they don't know about us. We don't have the media backing. We don't have the reporters from Fox,
right.
One American News, Newsmax, you know, knock on our door saying, hey, can you give me more information? What are you guys working on right now? What's the latest? They're not doing that. And they need to. And we need to reach out to them.
And that's why, they didn't want to allow anybody to give a contrary point of view.
Well, I've been censored since March 2nd when I first announced that there is no pandemic. The chloroquine kills COVID based on the Didier Raoult study in Marseille, France. So I've been censored since the beginning. So I know exactly how everybody feels about this. Someone else had a comment. I wanted to jump in. Was that Ben? And where's Brian?
I was just going to say that maybe, you know, certainly what's going on in Florida with Governor DeSantis and Dementia Joe attacking him all recently because he wouldn't order the poison for babies. So that may be, I think Florida's on the edge of cutting edge of being the leaders and for the whole country. And
well, wait a minute.
So
has Florida done that? Has Florida said they're not going to comply with this? They're not going to allow
Well, they're recommending against vaccinations for infants. If parents want to get them, they can still get them through their pediatrician or whatever, but the state of Florida is not going to order them. So basically, you know, DeSantis is sort of come out against the shots for children because he says the data is not there, and he's certainly right about that. The data is not there. They're not safe. They're not effective. We know this. So that's what's going on in Florida, and hopefully, you know, Florida will keep setting the trend for the rest of the country. So he's doing a great job.
Here's my theory. Safe is second base. Effective is third base. Is it necessary is first base. In Florida, right, we're talking about these under 5-year-old, 6-month to 5-year-old kids right now.
Mm-hmm.
How many? 27 kids out of 70,000 deaths. 27 kids under 5 in Florida died with COVID. To me, that's not a medical emergency when more kids drown that age.
Parents probably kill more kids than that.
So
neglect, abuse, and everything else.
Back to Jonathan.
Well, certainly
the
doctors knew that the numbers were that low from day one. We've known that all along. There was never an emergency. That was the charade.
Right. I disagree.
We've
I don't
all
think,
known that.
No, you knew the number was
most
27?
Most of the physicians in America know that the COVID death in children are exceedingly low. Exceedingly low.
They can't cite the numbers, though. You know, go back to California.
More children drown each year, more children getting killed by car wrecks every year in every state. More children drown and are killed by car wrecks than by COVID. Period.
But the only argument that I'm making is, if N number of children between 1 and 5, right, 1 to 4 years old, died in a given state, like California, right, they need to justify the EUA. In other words, the onus is on them, not on us. They have to prove that there's this need. And then
In utopia, they would have to prove the need. In reality, they didn't have to prove the need, and they're poisoning the masses. That's the reality we're dealing with.
So I'm asking John.
In a sane world, they would have to do what you're saying, but they don't because they're all corrupt and they're in control. We're living under communist rule right now in America, period. And they're doing whatever they want to do, ignoring all the rules.
Could we do an injunction, Jonathan, in order to say, hey, wait a second, the premise under which the EUA was granted, it's null and void. It doesn't exist. The fundamental assumption is,
I want to hear the answer to this. This is a great question. Jonathan?
The other thing, I agree. And the other thing, just to circle back to where we started when I got on, that one of the legal requirements and scientific inquiry should be is, does it work? And if what John Cullen is saying is, if you don't know what the danger is, how can you fulfill the legal and medical and practical requirement of, does it work? Is it reducing the danger if you're not even, you know, nobody wants to even talk about what the danger is? You know, if you don't know how many children are actually dying of that, how do you know it's being reduced by the vaccine?
Anybody?
Are you there?
I'm here. I'm just curious if anybody has a response to this.
It's like you can't fulfill, you know, it's like you say, well, if you take this cold medicine, you'll get better in 10 days. If you don't take the cold medicine, you'll get better in 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? It's like, does it, you know, can the FDA approve it?
It's actually worse than that. It says if you don't take the cold medicine, you'll probably get over it in a week and you won't get it again because you'll have immunity. If you do take the cold medicine, you could be dead in 3 months from a heart attack.
The wording in 21 U.S. Code 360 BBB is so straightforward, I don't think we even need metaphors. It says it has to diagnose it, treat it, or prevent the disease. It's not even legalese. I can understand.
Well, I think now they're claiming it's treatment because supposedly it reduces the severity of illness and reduces the likelihood of you dying. That's their talking point. Of course, that's not true. So I think they're trying to pretend it's a treatment now because clearly we know it doesn't prevent it. So you're right. But, you know, if somebody can file that and make it happen, great. So far it hasn't happened.
Well, let me tell you the bill, for in case you haven't read it. It's the FDA Emergency Use Authorization, Emergency Overhaul Act of 2020, written by Dr. Zelenko and myself. I'm trying to get him on the show. I've invited him for everyone, so hopefully when he's feeling better, he'll join us. Let me just get to here's the old language is pretty straightforward, as John says. 21 U.S. Code 60 BBB-3C3 says that there is no adequate, approved, and available alternative to the product for diagnosing, preventing, treating such disease or condition. Well, the fact is there was an adequate, approved, and available. Okay, so they violated that provision of the law. They violated a bunch of provisions. So that's when I wrote our proposed amendments, 360 BBB-3 authorization, is hereby amended with this language. The Secretary of Health and Human Services may issue an authorization under this section with respect to the emergency use of the product in consultation. Yada. That's the old law. The President may issue an authorization under this section in consultation with the Surgeon General. Okay, that's new. Congress may direct secretary to issue an authorization under this section through legislation signed by the president or through override of a veto. The point is, we took the basic emergency use authorization, opened it up to Congress, opened it up to the president, and then I said Congress shall, through open hearings, take testimony from private doctors, that's you folks, seeking an emergency use authorization who have independently tested a drug or combination of drugs, Ben, or therapies or technologies, that's Brian too, Jim as well, I don't want to leave anybody out, and have evidence, your names aren't in the bill, okay, and have evidence or testimony to present to the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, and or the House Energy and Commerce Committee regarding the efficacy or potential of their findings, trials, of the clinical study. So I actually brought you guys into the procedure where you had to be there in order to grant an EUA, okay? This is a powerful bill. This would change things, but it has to get out there. People have to know about it. And that's where you guys come in. But the bill has already been written since August 20th of 2020. So it's been there. Comments? Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jonathan.
And the thing is that legally, I would argue the language that there's no other effective alternative would perhaps, you know, not be right on target, but it would support the idea that how about doing nothing? You know, if not doing anything is as effective as taking the EUA approved medicine or whatever,
right,
then it doesn't it reinforces the fact that it doesn't qualify legally. Because there's no other effective alternative to handling this disease is a legal requirement.
Well, apparently, Dr. Death Fauci himself thought there was because he was taking hydroxychloroquine in February and March of 2020. So that could prove fraud intent right there, the fact that he himself was taking hydroxychloroquine. Why doesn't somebody in Congress get Fauci on the stand and say, were you taking hydroxychloroquine spring of 2020?
Probably still is
taking it. Because I have a friend that was in the COVID-19 task force, and according to my friend, he told the whole COVID-19 task force he was taking hydroxychloroquine. Of course, that's news
to the
rest of the
world. Can we get your friend on the show? Are they willing to come and talk to us, Ben?
He is not willing. He's afraid of losing his job and all that. But
okay.
I could let you talk to him, but he doesn't want his name being public.
Okay,
but
we'll get an affidavit, or just get a
statement. Certainly, that would proven Fauci, you know, grill Fauci on the stand about how he was taking that, and why would you take it if you didn't think it would work? And we know if there's one treatment that's effective, we know hydroxychloroquine works, ivermectin works, and even if there's one, then there's no EUA, and that's the whole
basis
of
the
EUA is destroyed. Of course, he's going
to
lie.
As much as I'd love to see him on the stand, he's going to lie.
But
so that's not really the point. But you don't have to. We've got the other evidence. We've got the evidence that
proves. Well, if you can prove he got prescriptions filled for hydroxychloroquine, there's a database somewhere. Unless he pulled them out of his ass, he got that prescription filled, right?
Oh,
so there should
okay.
be a record of it somewhere.
Huh.
Well,
in his record,
and
Jonathan.
Paul will ask. Rand Paul will ask next time he comes up on the Hill, which, you know, if you can get it to Rand Paul's office, Rand Paul will ask him that question.
Well, let's get Rand Paul. Let's get – I've tried to call his office. Let's get some of his staff here. Let's give him the questions that he needs to ask next time that you guys want to ask answered.
Well, Ben is actually right. Dr. Fauci did take hydroxychloroquine, but not only did Dr. Fauci take it, for the last 18 months, there's been multiple elected officials in the Congress and Senate on both sides of the aisle that have taken hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin.
Well, that's why they don't get sick. That's why politicians don't get COVID. And no politicians died from COVID. That's not a coincidence. I mean, the kids have died from injections, which is a tragedy. But do you have a list? Jim, can you document? Can you give us any kind of stuff we can use on that? Because that's huge news. The hypocrites.
I can't prove that, but I have it from good enough sources that I'm comfortable stating it on this program.
Well, okay. Well, then
next
the people
January,
need to know
Rand
that.
Paul will,
say it again. Say it again one more time.
Next January, when Republicans control the committees, they can subpoena his prescription records.
Well, that's true. But here's the thing, though. What if it were publicly known? What if we start saying that most of the Congress is a bunch of hypocrites, and they're all taking hydroxychloroquine, but they won't give it to you because they don't care if you die. I mean, that needs to be in a PSA. That needs to be nationally broadcast all the time. The Geldings, here's where the Geldings are at fault, the Gelding old party. They're not doing their bit. They're supporting
them. That's certainly true. We've treated a lot of celebrities and politicians, of course, because of HIPAA, we can't reveal who they are. But
no, I don't want to reveal who's treated. I want to know the congressional hypocrites that are on it. Yeah, you know, I don't want to say. Yeah, you can't reveal what you do, which is fine. That makes perfect sense, because nobody would go to you if you start, you know, breaking client privilege. However, the hypocrites in Congress that are voting against hydroxychloroquine, they're voting for these things. They're voting for the budgets of the health Nazis and Dr. Fascists. That's where the problem is. Those folks are public figures. That's different. If they're actively voting against the public having access to a drug that they personally are taking for their own personal safety, it's like armed guards for them, but no guns for us. It's the same argument. It's the elitism. Those people need to be outed. And I don't mind that kind of information going out.
Absolutely. And that would be wonderful if Rand Paul would ask the question to Fauci, did you take hydroxychloroquine in 2020 for any reason? That would be
anybody
an
have
awesome
a connection?
Question. I'd love
anybody
to
have a connection
hear
to his
him
office?
Do that.
Yeah, yeah. Anybody have a connection to Rand Paul's office? How about
I may indirectly because I'm officially
okay.
I'm a Kentucky colonel now, which
Ooh.
Is like Colonel Sanders. I was given the honorary title of Kentucky colonel, so I could maybe see if I can get a hold of Rand Paul.
Yeah, so was
a few people there. So
didn't Clarence Darrow get that when they did the Scopes Monkey trial? Didn't he become an honorary colonel of Tennessee?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I remember the movie Inherit the Wind. Yeah, yeah. So honorary
You're
colonel,
right.
Colonel Dr. Ben, let's talk.
I have too many nicknames, but yes.
Yeah, no, that's fine. But we need Rand Paul. And how about you've been on Senator Johnson's panel. We'll start talking to him.
Yes,
we've got two bills that he could use.
They're trying to arrange that with Senator Johnson. They're trying to get together, sort of like a committee idea where they bring in a certain number of physicians from our side versus, get Fauci to bring his minions in and just
have
a public hearing or debate about. Certainly
put me on the panel. Put me and Jonathan on the panel.
I have no control in this.
Put John on the panel.
They'll probably be afraid to put me on the panel, how that goes. But we'll see.
No, I'm serious about this.
I don't really. No, I'm serious, too. I don't know if I'm even going to be on the panel is what I'm saying. I want to be on it, but if I'm on it, will I certainly try to have others show up and be, participate? Sure.
Well, look what you've got. Johnson's a lawyer. Okay. I'm the premier citizen legislator in the country today. That sounds arrogant. I'm sorry, but it's true. Okay. And John's the data expert, par excellence. I don't know anybody that knows numbers like John Collin does. You put the three of us on the panel.
Clearly
you've got a whole force right there. Put the three of us on. I'm not saying you can do it. I'm not holding you responsible for doing it. I'm just saying that if we were on that panel, if we could talk directly to Senator Johnson, me with citizen legislation, Jonathan with his Washington experience and legal experience, and John Cullen with his numbers, everything changes. Because not only do we have the analysis of the problem, we have the solutions right there in front of everybody on TV. That's why this would work.
I'm sold on that idea, so I'll try to make some contacts and see, there's other people already working on this, and I'm sort of on the fringe of the being in the loop, but I'm really not in the loop.
Well,
everybody
does what they can.
I'll see what I can find out, and if we can make it happen, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, I think so.
There are some things that are very hard to do without context, but when it's something that Rand Paul has been on a tear about for, a year and a half or two, I don't think it would require any great special. I mean, you just pick up the phone and call his office and talk. Find out what people want to do.
Yeah, I haven't gotten there yet.
What if you guys contacted Rand Paul and said, listen, we're attorneys and we're preparing a bill to impact 21 U.S. Code 360 BBB, and we want to talk to Rand Paul about it?
We've already got the bill. I've already written the bill.
That's what I mean. And if you
would have to write it, it's there.
If you two approach him and say, look, we're a couple of attorneys. We want to talk to you about this bill.
I'm not an attorney.
I thought you had a JD. I'm sorry.
No. I just got a couple of bachelor degrees, but I think big.
All right. But you're a pilot and a flight instructor, so that makes up for it.
And a writer and author and some other guitar player. Right. Yeah. But this is all made up. But more than anything else, I am an entrepreneur of ideas, and that's really what drives me.
I like the idea of getting an injunction for the following five reasons, right? And we heard from, you know, Dr. Thorpe, we heard from Dr. Artis, we heard from Dr. Marble, we heard, you know, we have all these great reasons to have an injunction. What do we need to do to roll that ball downhill? How do we get that going?
We need the judge who did the mask mandates, and we also should contact Rand Paul about holding his own commission or committee like, you know, Ron Johnson did.
Well, the EUA have to be terminated by Xavier Becerra? Doesn't the Secretary of HHS have?
Well, they keep extending it. They keep extending the declaration. Well, Jonathan knows better on this. Jonathan, don't they have a declaration of emergency and they have to do that, and then they can extend the EUA? How does that work?
But if they yes, but if they, you know, a court can also rule that they never had authority to do it. It didn't comply with the legal requirements.
Okay, that's what we need. So let's go to Rand Paul. Let's see if you know if he can do that as a bill, or at least have him maybe contact judges, because he knows judges, I'm sure. They'll go to lunch together. You know, there's got to be a way to make this connection. This is where I wanted this panel to go. I want to do stuff.
Okay.
Not just complain about it.
Okay.
All right. You want to take a break for a few minutes? You guys want to go
if
grab
anybody
some...
has Rand Paul's number, I'll call it today. Send me his number.
Well, I mean, if you just want his office, the Capitol switchboard, everyone should know, 202-225-3121. And then you ask them, I want...
Could you repeat that again? 225
Why don't you call during the break?
202-225-3121.
I'll look it up right now.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, so Rand, I got to take a couple minutes anyway, just let you guys take a break, because we only have about another hour and 15 minutes, believe it or not. So Rand Paul, phone number.
Well, I mean, that's the Capitol switchboard.
I know that's the main number.
And it actually
does
work.
To it.
You can actually get anywhere from there.
Contact Senator Rand Paul. Here we go. Washington, D.C., 202-224-4343.
Yeah, direct office number. You can go to Senate.gov or you can go to House.gov to get a lot of great information.
Yep, and it's Washington, D.C. Yeah, 202-224-4343 is the direct line to Senator Rand Paul. That is public information. We're not sharing anything that everybody can't find out.
And he's the senator from Kentucky, right? He's the Kentucky senator, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we come back from the break, I'll share with the audience how many people died from COVID in Kentucky and how many were children.
Interesting. And I want to talk to you because you're looking for evidence, you're looking for criteria as to what constitutes an emergency. I'm going to go back to the 2007 Pandemic Severity Index. That's going to kind of shock you as to what they considered emergency. So let me play our new Federalist number 12 for this week. And I'm going to mute all your lines so you can make lots of noise, and then I'll let you know when I'm bringing you back on. So about 7 or 8 minutes, we'll take a break, and we'll be back. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, SRV1776.com. That's SRV1776.com. Even the title of Federalist Number 12 is bad. The utility of the Union in respect to revenue. First of all, the Union was not created for Alexander Hamilton, who wrote Federalist Number 12, to rule it. Nor was the Union created for his utility, nor for the Union to generate revenue. Hamilton says, "The prosperity of commerce is now perceived and acknowledged by all enlightened statesmen to be the most useful as well as the most productive source of national wealth, and has accordingly become a primary object of their political cares." Such grand assumptions. All enlightened statesmen? So those who disagree must be stupid by comparison. Commerce is supposed to bring wealth. That's why we engage in it. But commerce is for private wealth, entrepreneurial wealth, investor wealth, and more. It is not for therefore governed national wealth unless the commerce is nationalized. Maybe that's what Hamilton had in mind when he talked about commerce becoming, quote, a primary object of their political cares. Hamilton and the Federalists appear to believe that not only the Constitution and the federal government should serve elitists like himself, but the commerce of the nation should also. I can see why the anti-federalists were so popular, and why people are encouraged by government to study only the Federalist Papers. Consider this paragraph. The ability of a country to pay taxes must always be proportioned in a great degree to the quantity of money in circulation and to the celerity with which it circulates. Commerce, contributing to both these objects, must of necessity render the payment of taxes easier and facilitate the requisite supplies to the treasury. In other words, don't tax more than a certain portion of the money supply so taxes flow in easily. So the goal here is to tax not on the necessary expenditures of government, but on how great a proportion the federal government can tax to facilitate supplies of money to the treasury most easily. It's also interesting that Hamilton does not trust the states at all regarding commerce or anything else, which is ironic because it's the states that delegate all power to the federal government through the Constitution. But Hamilton is so contemptuous of the states. He thinks their purpose is to conspire to commit commerce in a way the federal government could not tax. Again, according to Hamilton, like people, businesses are to serve the federal government. He says, the relative situation of these states, the number of rivers with which they are intersected, and of bays that wash their shores, the facility of communication in every direction, the affinity of language and manners, the familiar habits of intercourse, all these are circumstances that would conspire to render an illicit trade between them a matter of little difficulty and would ensure frequent evasions of the commercial regulations of each other. Stating things not at all in evidence that they are in fact evident, Hamilton once again claims that only a national, not federal, national, as in a top-down supremacist government, can be trusted to collect the taxes and keep the treasury full. Whereas the states, which are sovereign entities, will break into confederacies and ruin all Hamilton's plans to run the economy with the national government. He concludes, it is therefore evident that one national government would be able, at much less expense, to extend the duties on imports beyond comparison further than would be practicable to the states separately or to any partial confederacies. The only thing that is evident to me is that Alexander Hamilton wants a strong national government so his fellow elitists can control the economy and put away money in the treasury based on how much money they can get away with putting in the treasury and use for their own purposes. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Pankless Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com. This is Greg Pankless. So what is Action Radio? It is a radio show with its own citizen legislature. That's you, the listener. It is a fully interactive system of listeners, expert guests, social media, writing bills, legislator input, bill submission, lobbying, and citizen action. Action Radio is the future of talk radio using all the available technology in one completely integrated new system. You are listening to Action Radio Online with Greg Pankless. The webpage for all Action Radio shows and podcasts is blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Please share our show with all your friends and family, both nationally and internationally. The guiding principle of Action Radio is this: we the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed. All right, just a warning to our guests, I'm going to be bringing them back on in just about 20 seconds here after I play this. Action Radio, dedicated to fixing everything. Yeah, that's way too quiet. I have to turn that up for next time. But anyway, that's all these volume level things I get to play with here. All right, so it looks like some of our panel departed so they could contact Rand Paul's office, which I think is hysterical. So we'll see what happened. I think Ben just sent me a message, something to that effect. We'll wait until he gets back on. I've got Jim Thorpe, I've got John Cullen, and I've got Brian Artis. So it looks like Jonathan left us also too. So he probably made a call. So we'll find out what happens. Brian, we haven't heard from you yet. Can you enter and sign in, please, and tell us what you think of what we're doing here so far? We'll see if he's there. Going once, going twice. Brian, you there?
Well, I think you guys are doing a great job, and I always love being a part of this panel. I've actually just got a few meetings I had to be a part of and just wanted to listen in.
Oh,
I just
want
to appreciate that. I appreciate Cullen's data. I love it. And anyone who wants to see the data, go to cdc.gov, the data tracker. Go look at it. It's there for you to see it. I personally have a hard time trusting anything the CDC does, reports. We actually know that as early as March of 2020, the CDC was telling hospitals and clinicians around the world, particularly America, that even if no one tested for COVID, they were incentivizing them to call it COVID, diagnose it COVID, even if it was the flu or pneumonia that tested positive. So the data from the CDC is going to be hard to trust, but it's still pretty pathetic. I mean, it's pathetic. I mentioned in a text a minute ago that I looked at it last week for children ages 0 to 4 in the United States who died with COVID on the CDC's COVID data tracker. It was 442 children. All I did was then Google how many children are in the United States right now that are ages 0 to 4. It was 19.7 million. So do the math. Take 442 divided by 19.7 million. You get a percentage of children who died with COVID, possibly 0.00002%. That is four zeros before the two. There is no justification whatsoever to give an experimental, non-approved, zero ever approved, and no long-term safety studies ever experimental drug to inject into the arm of a kid, a newborn, a six-month-old. It doesn't matter. It's unjustified.
There's no need. Right.
There's not even justification for anybody over 70 to get these shots. The numbers do not match up.
Yep.
Nothing. There's nothing in relation to COVID.
Well, the numbers you're citing,
a vaccine, period.
I want to tell the audience that the numbers that you're citing off the top of your head are spot on. I'm looking at the system live right now, and the number
I'm walking
you just
into a building
cited,
right now.
Yeah, the number you just cited is spot on. 442 is exactly the right number. That's how many children
died that were under 5 years old in the United States, 442. Brian's right on the money. Exactly correct.
Now that's with COVID, not from COVID. We have to put the from factor. So let's add the from factor. And it's like what, 5% of that?
Right. So 25 kids.
25 kids. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me jump in here. So,
sure.
Brian, thank you for that figure. So there's 19.7 million kids under the age of four, Brian and John, 442 dead, and you're looking at a 0.00002%. Okay, that's about 20 in a million. Okay, 0.00002. Just we opened up this Action Talk Radio with the numbers that I just calculated from Bears by estimating the 11.39 billion COVID vaccine doses over the last 18 months, actual percentage of major adverse events. You're not talking about per million. You're talking about per hundred, 1.9% risk of adverse event. You're looking at 2.5% risk of death for each COVID vaccination, 3.7% risk of myocarditis, pericarditis, 3.7% risk. That's numerator and denominator for a vaccine, 4.7% risk from permanent disability, 2.8% risk from other life-threatening adverse events, 3.7% with reported severe allergic reactions, anaphylactic reactions, presumably from PEG and the other lipid nanoparticle components. That, all those compared with what Brian and what John just reviewed, those per hundred with per million chance of the baby having those complications from COVID.
It seems like a strong case. Again, who would we have to explain this to that isn't going to understand that?
Well, it makes sense to me. I wish we had Jonathan back. He left. Hopefully I'll text him in a minute, see if he can call back in. But to us, it's open and shut case, but it always has been. We have to just present this to the public in a way that they're getting information that contradicts everything they've been told. And so there's going to be resistance to that. So we have to find a way to almost overwhelmingly present this information. Let me anybody have a comment on that? Then I want to tell John.
Yeah, I do.
We talked a little bit before. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, if there's any attorneys in the audience that are listening to the show that have creative ideas and are like, you know what, I want to get involved. I want to help out here. I think I know how we might be able to do this. How could they get in touch with you, Greg, if they wanted to – you know, reach out and say, you know, I think I got an idea. I think I might.
Best way to reach me Facebook. You know, if you want to be a friend, anybody who's going to be an activist is going to be, you know, I got room for Facebook friends, but my public email is greg@writeyourlaws.com. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me. Almost impossible by phone, except when I'm on the show. It's kind of funny, but greg@writeyourlaws.com, WriteYourLaws is the best way to do that. All right. Just text Jonathan. Hopefully he'll call us back. Yeah, in fact, Jonathan is interesting that one of the campaigns he was working on, because he's defending some of the folks in the political prison, in the D.C. jail and otherwise. In fact, we had two amazing calls from Stuart Rhodes, who is the head of the Oath Keepers. He's the founder. He called us from the Oklahoma Federal Prison, all right, because Jonathan's a lawyer. So Stuart calls Jonathan. Jonathan puts a call on conference, and so we have two incredible calls about that. So Jonathan's pretty well versed in a lot of this stuff. And that's what makes them such a valuable resource to us here. Any more comments on this? Then I want to tell you about, because answer John's question from earlier, what is the criteria? What determines an emergency? And I'll tell you exactly how they used to do it and then how it was gotten rid of. Further questions, Jim? Or I think Brian's busy now, so it's just like Jim and John. Going once, going twice? All right. 2007. The way I found this was that I looked at the current guidelines. I said, well, why are they, where do these mandates come from? Where are these lockdowns? Where are these, where is this social distance? Where does this, you know, close down of businesses, school closures, you know, all that kind of stuff. Where did that all come from? I said, well, there have to be guidelines. So I looked them up and I found them, 2017. And I said, well, that's curious. You know, they were enacted 3 months after Trump took office. That's interesting. What were the guidelines before that? Well, 2007. And this is where I found something called the Pandemic Severity Index. So, John, you're asking, I've sent you this information, so I don't know if you had a chance to go over it. Mm-hmm. The question is, how did they determine an emergency? Well, this is how they used to do it. And I found, let me just introduce the paragraph here. This is from the 2007, look at the exact thing, what it says here. The Interim Pre-Pandemic Planning Guidance, Community Strategy for Pandemic Influenza Mitigation in the United States, early targeted layered use of non-pharmaceutical interventions, and it's from, you guessed it, the CDC, all right? And this was dated February 2007. So let me scroll down again to my Pandemic Severity Index, where it says, this guidance introduces for the first time a Pandemic Severity Index, which uses case fatality ratio as the critical driver for categorizing the severity of a pandemic. And then you got figure A, figure B, which you can't see until you look it up. All right. The index is designed to enable an estimation of the severity of a pandemic on a population level to allow better forecasting of the impact of a pandemic and to make and to enable recommendations to be made on the use of mitigation interventions that are matched to the severity of future influenza pandemics. Let me give you the categories. So as you might want to either write these down or keep a good mental note. A Category 1 pandemic is less than 90,000 people killed by it. I'm assuming this is from, not with, but from, okay? So now we've got Category 2, 90,000 to 450,000, so that's almost 500,000. Category 3, 450,000 to 900,000, that's almost 1,000,000. Category 4, 900,000 to 1.8 million people. And Category 5, the worst pandemic, is greater than 1.8 million people. So just take that 1 million number, we're barely into a Category 4 pandemic, and we all know that 95% of those people could have been saved. So we're actually at a Category 1, less than 90,000. Fascinating, huh? Now, here are the recommendations. Category 1, for voluntary isolation. This isn't quarantine. This is just isolation. In other words, you're staying home, right? It says of ill at home adults and children combined with the use of, what does it say, antiviral treatment. Oh, that would be hydroxychloroquine as available and indicated. It's interesting, they say antiviral treatment. So they're already looking at hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin in 2007. Home voluntary isolation. It's like when you have a cold, you stay home. Recommended for all categories. No brainer. Voluntary quarantine. This is different. All right. You know how everybody had to quarantine for 2 weeks? Just based on a PCA, PCA? What was the test? You know what I mean? Yeah. Thank you. Voluntary quarantine. This is back in 2007, right? Voluntary quarantine of household members in homes with ill persons, adults and children. Consider combining with antiviral prophylaxis if effective. That'd be hydroxychloroquine. You know, they don't say it. I'm just mentioning that. Feasible and quantity sufficient. So voluntary quarantine, even with the pandemic out there, is generally not recommended for Category 1. You would consider it for 2 and 3. It's only recommended for Category 4 and 5 pandemic. So they're not even recommending quarantine. Voluntary. Until at least, what, 900,000 people have been killed by the pandemic? That's kind of staggering compared to what we went through, right? Category 4 starts at 900,000. All right, let me get the next category here. School, child, social distancing. Dismissal of students from schools and school-based activities and closures of child care programs. Generally not recommended for Category 1. Yeah, consider for maybe a couple of weeks for Category 2 and 3, and then again, only recommended for Category 4 and 5 pandemics. Workplace, you know the lockdowns, right? Decreased number of social contacts, encouraged teleconferences, alternatives, face-to-face meetings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Generally not recommended for Category 1, consider for Category 2 and 3, and it's only recommended for Categories 4 and 5, and that's above 900,000 for Category 4 and above 1.8 million for Category 5. So there's your old criteria, John. That's what they were considering a real pandemic was a Category 4, is what it looks like.
So those were the criteria back in the day. That was like 2009,
2010. No, 2007 until 2017. Yeah, that was the criteria.
Okay. So when we went through the H1N1 swine flu pandemic, 12,000 people died. Now, there's 12,000 people dead from COVID, you know, let me pick a state. Kentucky's got more than that. So in the 2009 swine flu pandemic, this is kind of an important thing to keep in mind. Only 12,000 people died in the country, according to the CDC and Dr. Fauci. And I found that to be remarkably odd, given that the WHO declared a global pandemic and that, you know, they were kind of panic stricken back in 2009. And this is when Tamiflu was the hot product, right? Everybody was trying to get Tamiflu in case they got the swine flu so that they could treat it. And Tamiflu is oseltamivir. And I know a lot of doctors have problems with oseltamivir. They do not like the product and do not recommend it. And
yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, Dr. Thorpe, I don't know if you want to talk about Tamiflu oseltamivir and why it's a bit of a hot potato in the medical world or not.
Well, let's find out, John. Sure. Jim, excuse me.
Sure, I can. Well, you're looking at the recurrent issue of disaster capitalism and abuse of the healthcare system and the American taxpayers. This classic offshoot of Naomi Klein and the horrible corporate technocracy that we're involved with that has taken away all of our freedoms. So yeah, Tamiflu was a drug that was heavily invested by the stakeholders, including the politicians. It was propped up and in essence mandated in the flu, and it made profits that were just unbelievably gross profits. And the efficacy was in essence exaggerated by looking at the relative versus the absolute success rates, if you will. So there was a very, very marginal, clinically insignificant improvement in symptoms. I mean, it was so ridiculous. So they basically pushed this drug. Billions of dollars were made on it, and it really didn't do anything.
Well, it sounds like deja vu. Sounds like a movie I've seen. Sounds like...
Well, SARS-CoV-1, SARS-CoV-2, like EZT-AIDS,
They only have one playbook? I mean, have we seen this before? Well, the reason this is so spectacular is that this 2009 H1N1 global pandemic, swine flu, supposedly, according to the CDC and Dr. Fauci, only claimed 12,000 lives.
Well, so that's Category 1 under the 2007 guidelines. In fact, it's low Category 1.
Yeah, 12,000 people died in the whole country through the whole pandemic, whereas like right now with COVID, Maryland has almost 15,000 dead. So that's more than the entire H1N1 swine flu thing just in Maryland right now, right? So you don't have to go very far to all of a sudden think, you know, again, the cognitive dissonance can be important and powerful. When things don't add up and everything sounds weird and wrong, that probably means there's subterfuge nearby.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well,
and when you go to the swine flu vaccination in 1976, it's even worse.
Yeah, that was a disaster.
It broke out around Fort Detrick, Maryland. The administration got very, very anxious about it. They rapidly developed the vaccination. And there were less than 25 people that died from the vaccination, and it was immediately aggressively removed from the market.
Well, wait a minute. In fact, I'm going to bring – we have one of our returning guests from the first show, Tiffany Ferrato, is on the line, which is fabulous. Welcome back. But wait a minute. You know, they're not even using the same guidelines. Everything that they learned, supposedly, from these earlier things, from even AZT and AIDS, you know, when they got rid of Bactrim, you know, they had the wrong drug. You know, all the way through now, they've seen all, you're talking about the same playbook. Not only have they violated the same, it's like all the lessons they learned for not being able to do their conspiratorial marketing campaign, they used this time. But they're not even using the right criteria. They actually changed all the rules, like I say, in 2017 to be able to do what they're doing now. So I don't know. This is just frustrating. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Well, that's not really a question. Let me bring Tiffany on. And see, I don't know. Have you had a chance to listen to where we were? Because we've been trucking along here. Okay.
Yeah, that's actually what I have a question about. So,
okay. Go ahead.
Thinking about swine flu and how it all feels so similar, right? It's out of the same playbook, the same strategy, everything. I'm curious if we think that swine flu was maybe a practice run for preparing or building something like this with regards to fast-tracking the vaccine or marketing campaigns around it or trying to fear-monger. And then that brings me to my next question is, do we think this COVID experience is another practice run for something bigger?
Oh, two good questions. Yeah, let's take them both. Trial run. I would say absolutely. But it's interesting that they had to change the rules because they realized that the current guidelines, the 2007. Tiffany, did you hear my chat on the original pandemic guidelines, the 2007 ones?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So you're up on that. But then it seems really suspicious. This is actually how I knew this was all planned. When Judy says a plandemic, I knew when they changed the rules to get rid of the pandemic severity index that you could go to lockdowns immediately, that this was all in the works because they needed to do that to create the fear, to create the lower resistance, to preserve COVID in people until they could bring their snake oil jab on, you know, like 6 months later. And so this seems to me all pre-planned, and they realized the mistakes they made, so they changed the rules so they could do it the way they wanted to this time. How's that for a theory? Let's go to John and Jim. And go ahead, Tiffany.
That's my theory, too.
Okay. Well, we're all on board. Well, let me ask you a question, Tiffany, because you're the marketing expert with a degree in manipulation, which is one of the single best lines I've heard on the show yet. So if you were trying to plan a PR campaign, if you wanted to scare the hell out of people, if you wanted to market a product that was dangerous in itself, that is going to kill untold numbers of people as well as give every kind of injury you can think of, if you were trying to do that, could you think of a better way than with a man-made virus, an entire marketing campaign to go with it? Is what they're doing?
No.
Go ahead. What do you think?
And, well, I mean, that's exactly how I would do it. And I find it really interesting as I kind of pay attention to how things are going. That's why I was asking what you guys thought about swine flu, because I remember the swine flu and it was scaring people, but there were mistakes that were made and it fell flat pretty quickly because people found out that it wasn't what they the perception that they were giving. And what they did is they changed the rules and they changed the strategy, like A/B testing with market analysis, and recognized that they needed to make sure that people didn't know how bad it wasn't or the truth. And so from my perspective, almost all of this COVID chaos has been a marketing campaign, and they've done an exceptional job of it.
How do we defeat it? How do we do a counter marketing campaign given our limited budgets and reach until we're all, you know, famous and all that kind of good stuff? What's the best way to counter that marketing campaign?
Well, this is what we talked a little bit about on the last show, which I found really interesting, is I think that there's a lot of layers to the approach, right? Obviously, we need to continue to investigate and bring as much truth in the science as possible. We also need to do the lawsuits and sue the people who are in charge of making these poor decisions. But a huge piece of it is really, because it started with a marketing campaign and shaking up the population, is finding ways to do that again. And I think that really paying attention to not only putting the science out there and the truth out there, but being really strategic with how we communicate about it and making it okay to have conversations again, and really baby step. I mean, these people are traumatized, right? At the end of the day, they're traumatized. They're a bunch of victims, and we have to peel them out of that. And we're not going to do it with the science that they are already denying, right? So we have to do it through marketing and communication. And really, because of the censorship issues, I think it comes down to the individual and the community and talking about what you know and being open and not being afraid to share your opinion on it. Because I think people in the back of their minds are already starting to doubt it, but they're in denial. And if we just make it, as humans, on a day-to-day basis, okay to talk about the things that we have questions about, I think that Elvis slow, we can evolve people into waking up, because I think it's already happening. I can feel the shift.
Yeah, yeah. If you can help with, like I said, the two bills, and I'm asking everybody on the panel to, every time you're on another panel, every time you're on a show, every time any media exposure, anytime uh-huh. you're in front of a congressional committee or a person, two bills. One, full product vaccine liability. And two, elimination of big tech censorship with a few minor changes to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. That's all it'll take to change
yep.
everything. Now, did you have
yep.
a chance to take a look at those two bills? We got a little bit of background noise. Tiffany, I guess you're driving, it sounds like, maybe?
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's okay. Well, listen, I'd rather have you than not have you, so it's not a problem. Did you get a chance to take a look, or do you want to talk about those maybe at a subsequent week? I know I gave them to you yesterday.
Yeah, I haven't dug too deep into them yet, but... We'll talk about them in the next
time. We'll do it next time. Yeah, that sounds good. Any reaction to our marketing campaign? Well, just to let you know, we talked about contacting Dinesh D'Souza. We want like a 2,000 mules for COVID. Jonathan Mosley, our legal reporter, was on earlier. We're going to try and get an injunction, maybe from the same judge that that put the mask injunction on. And I think as everybody left for a break, they all called up Rand Paul's office. I know Ben Marvel did. So we're going to try and get him to do some hearings too. So those are the things that we covered before you got here. It's been a busy day.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. All right. John, Tiffany, you should introduce yourself because I think you were here. I think John started the second show, so you two might not have talked yet. So you should give a couple quick sentences on what you do, and then.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I'm Tiffany Perotto. I'm a professional marketing and communication strategist, and so I work with a lot of groups like Millions Against Medical Mandates, Children's Health Defense Florida, Health Freedom Florida. And I work with Dr. Jim Thorpe and Dr. Christian Northrup on My Cycle Story, where we dug into the research on potential shedding and the COVID vaccine's effects on women's menstrual cycles that we've been seeing, that we talked a little bit about on the last show, I think. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, just...
Well, I want to introduce you to John Cullen because you two might be able to work together. He's the data genius that created the Johns Hopkins map of COVID that you see, you know, worldwide. That's him. And so, you know, anything you want to know about numbers, you know, he's our numbers expert. Well, he's not just our numbers expert. He's the only worldwide numbers expert. So that might be – John, do you have questions for Tiffany as far as marketing goes or getting your information out? That might be interesting.
Well, Tiffany – hi, Tiffany. This is John. How are you?
Hi, John. Good.
So you said at the beginning of your segment, you said, you know, is this some sort of a trial run? The swine flu? Was the swine flu in 2009 some sort of, you know, kind of trial run for this? And I want to mm-hmm. drill into that a little bit. And then you said, you know, and is what we're going through now, is this a setup for another pandemic? And I thought that was an interesting question because Joe Biden just said something in the last 24 hours and said he needs more money because there's going to be another pandemic. And then within hours of him saying that, we've got polio being detected in the UK. We're now up to over 100 monkey virus, whatever we're calling it now. Is there a new politically correct term that I need to use? Let me know. I didn't
Not
think
on this
monkey.
Show. We call monkeypox. That's
monkey
what they
call it.
We don't want to offend too many monkeys.
Yeah, I know. I didn't mean to offend. Like, if anybody listening is a chimpanzee or identifies, we don't mean any offense.
Exactly.
But there's over 100 cases of monkeypox, and now they're talking about polio in the UK. Mm. An outbreak of polio, the headlines of Drudge Report. So let's go back to the first thing that Tiffany said, which, and I think Tiffany made an observation or made a comment that's very important, which is given the degree of censorship,
mm-hmm.
it's important to stick to the facts, the hard facts. And that's why I've been able to skirt most of the censorship, not entirely, but because I'm posting CDC data, what are they going to say? Right. It's hard to argue with Walensky's numbers.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
There's another aspect here that's important to understand. I bring these numbers forward sometimes tongue in cheek. right? But again, they're always the official numbers. They're the CDC's numbers, they're the WHO's numbers, they're Johns Hopkins' numbers. And the reason this is important to kind of make a mental note of, everybody remembers Bernie Madoff?
Yep.
Bernie Madoff and that whole operation of his was a complete house of cards. There were no trades. Now, the guy who figured this out is a guy named Harry Markopoulos. And Harry Markopoulos figured out what Bernie Madoff was doing by basically auditing the books and the statements, knowing full well it was entirely a facade and there was nothing there. But the point is, you're not going to catch Bernie Madoff unless you audit the books, even if you know the books are nonsense. You still have to do it. And so Harry Markopoulos was the guy who said, no, this doesn't add up. And that's how they caught Bernie Madoff. So even though the entire bookkeeping system that Madoff had was entirely made up, it was a complete house of cards, Markopoulos still had to audit it in order to demonstrate that it was nonsense. And effectively, that's what I'm doing with the CDC, the WHO, and Johns Hopkins.
You need to publish or put this together somewhere, so with like a summary that's easily accessible for us talk show hosts and other folks. But yeah, that's exactly what you're doing. And then we can take that audit and see if we can get Tiffany, our latest thing, like I say, is to get an injunction. There's no reason why a judge can't say that the procedure was not followed legally, the Administrative Procedures Act was violated, the evidence isn't there, it's not safe and effective, it's not working, and therefore there was no reason to grant an emergency use authorization besides the fact that there is no emergency. So all those factors that combine in should be able to get us to overturn this. That's our current our strategy here.
I want to go back to what Tiffany asked, though, at the beginning, which was,
sure,
was that swine flu 2009, was that kind of a trial run, or did they learn something then that they are using this time around?
And the answer is...
this is where I have to speculate. So there's a difference between the data that I report, right? So before the break, I promised the audience that I would tell them how many people died in Rand Paul's Kentucky and how many of them were children. I promised that.
Oh,
so when I tell you that, that's not speculation, right? That's straight from the CDC. That's data. That's not my opinion. That's why, you know, it doesn't really matter. This is coming from the CDC. So when I tell you Kentucky, Rand Paul's Kentucky, 16,792 people have died with COVID. That's CDC number. That's not my speculation. And the number of children that have died out of the 16,792, Tiffany, why don't you have some fun with this? Children from zero, from birth to 17 in Kentucky, out of 16,792 people that died, how many of them were children from 0 to 17?
I would guess 12.
Boy, you guys are good. Between you and
listen
artists,
to you, John.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah.
The number is 14. The number is 14. 14 children in Kentucky between birth and 17 died out of the 16,792 deaths. So to me, that's not a pediatric medical emergency. Right? More kids were trampled by horses and died in Kentucky.
Wasn't it Steve Kirsch this week who put an article out? Was it Maryland where they looked into the number of deaths? Well, because they approved the vaccine for children under 6 months old or younger, under five years old. And he looked into it, and I think in the whole state of, I think it was Maryland, I could be wrong, there was only one child that supposedly died with COVID, and he actually reached out to the family and found out that she had congenital heart disease, and so she did not actually even die of COVID, and now they're administering these vaccines that are killing children. Yeah. And
you should tell Steve Kirsch to get in touch with me, and I'll keep him out of jail. The number of people that died in Maryland, the number of kids that died in Maryland is 21, and you know, I built the map, he got rich. right? So this is my domain, not his. So when it comes to how many people died in Maryland, between 0 and 17, the number's 21.
Yeah, I think it was more specific to what they approved with the younger kids.
Okay, so under five.
Not
yeah.
all the way
under
up.
Five. Yeah, under five, it could be one kid. It could be just one kid under 5 years old. That's quite possible. So that's the point here, is that these numbers are so ridiculously small, it doesn't quite constitute a pediatric medical emergency, let alone an obstetric medical emergency.
I'm in the state of Florida, and we have several hundred drowning deaths a year of children, young children, because they fall in the pool. But they're still allowing people to have pools, right? They're not considering it a pediatric emergency and making sure that all pools are only 16 inches deep in the event that a child falls in. That's just not the way we do things. It's ridiculous.
All right, back to H1N1 swine flu 2009. Was it a dry run? Doesn't it seem odd that only 12,000 people died? Doesn't that seem
Here's what seems strange, though. I go back to they changed the rules. So not only was it a dry run, they realized all the problems with the things that they wanted to implement, the lockdowns, the masks, the school closures, the beach closures, everything that they did. The travel. They couldn't have done that, the masks on the airplanes. They couldn't have done any of that operating under the 2007 guidelines. Now, it's not a coincidence that they changed the guidelines 3 months after Trump takes office, because they're already planning to get him out. So you want to talk about a dry run? You know, COVID,
well,
what I originally heard, they were trying
global.
To do it. Go ahead.
But once again, it was global. So back then,
it's
I think
a twofer.
It was Margaret Chen.
Yeah.
It was Margaret Chen was the head of the WHO, right? And
mm-hmm.
I believe they declared a global swine flu pandemic, got all kinds of video footage from 2009. Now, the thing that I find odd is that with all that hullabaloo, 12,000 deaths, so just to put it in perspective, in 2017, 2018, Dr. Fauci says we had 80,000 people die of the flu, 10,000 died in Texas. So if 10,000 people died of the flu in Texas in 2017, and in 2009 we had this huge epidemic, pandemic, Margaret Chen, World Health Organization, swine flu, and 12,000 people died in the whole country. Hmm. So to Tiffany's question, did something happen during that they learned and built the playbook? And Tiffany, you know what I think happened? Something accidental.
And what was
it? Stumbled upon strategy?
I think somebody left a zero off the report, and nobody asked a damn thing about it. Nobody questioned it.
Where was the zero left off?
12,000 dead? No, it was 120,000 that died. But when they came out and said 12,000, it was a typo, and nobody said a thing. Nobody questioned, what do you mean only 12,000 died? And all of a sudden, Dr. Fauci realizes, nobody questions me. And that's the Milgram experiment.
Which is what?
The Milgram experiment, I bet you, Dr. Marble, Dr. Artis will tell you guys the story. The Milgram experiment is fascinating. It's kind of, I forget if it was at Yale or at Princeton, but the Milgram experiment, they put somebody in the room with you who's a PhD, doctor, whatever, in the white coat, whatever, and we're doing some sort of test, and you're testing the person on the other side. You can't see them, but you talk to them through the
microphone. I know what this is.
And when they get the thing wrong, you buzz them, and they're actually getting an electric shock on the other side. And the more questions they get wrong, the more voltage they're getting. And in the Milgram experiment, as they start giving these people the electric shocks, the person on the other side is starting to scream. And the guy in the white coat says, no, that's part of the test. That's what this is for. That's why you're here, right? So keep going. And with the person on the other side screaming in pain, just because there's somebody there in a white coat, they keep applying this. and this is the Milgram experiment. You guys can look this up on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Dr. Fauci is the stand-in in the Milgram experiment. Dr. Fauci says, and so we're going, okay, Dr. Fauci says. And when they said that there only were 12,000 dead, this was a global pandemic. 10,000 people died in Texas in 2017. How did only 12,000 die in the whole country? Doesn't it sound more reasonable that maybe 120,000 died? Mm-hmm. If 80,000 died in 2017-18, wouldn't 120,000 be a more rational number? Well, right after the 2009 swine flu, they changed the rules. They changed the rules, and they invented something called influenza burden, which is where they started to combine pneumonia and influenza. So this is the genesis of PNI and influenza burden. And recently I had a video that exposes what is influenza burden, taken down off of YouTube, because it appears this is modus operandi.
This is before they changed the guidelines, too. This is before the 2017 guidelines, so they're already changing things to change the index. Hey, let me ask Tiffany a bizarre question. Is there a marketing and a PR department? Are we paying for these people to analyze their public relations strategies at CDC, NIH, FDA? Do you know if they have marketing folks there?
Oh, absolutely. Of course they do. I mean, they have public relations. I would be willing to bet a huge percentage of the money going in there is being spent on marketing, because it really, it's really the only possible way for this pandemic to be successful is investing in the right, air quotes, right way people to cause the effect that they want. It's all PR and marketing.
Is that legal? Is that something we can use against them? If it's false information,
you know,
they're always big on fake information.
Yeah, but it's through partnerships, so there's loopholes. So they can't, for example, they're not allowed to market and, like, put on commercials for the COVID vaccine, but they work with their partners who are able to do that. So they invest in partnerships and affiliations, and that's where they get it. So it's illegal, but they're probably working the loopholes.
Interesting. So it was a dry run. Yeah. All this has been planned. All of it. Judy's right. It's all a pandemic, which is really crazy. All right. We've got about 22 minutes left. I got that. In fact, I had several articles for today's show talking about Brandon.
Can I drop a bomb show?
Yeah, please do. I can do these articles anytime. Yeah. I got a quote from Brandon on his new pandemic. Go ahead.
So, Tiffany, you said you're in Florida, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to give you some numbers, and from a marketing standpoint, if these numbers were known by the parents of school-age children, do you think it would make a difference? And you've worked with a couple of the different groups that are talking about the vaccines and, you know, the issues with the vaccines, the downside of the vaccine, the risks of the vaccine. Sort of the premise I'm bringing forward is I don't think they're necessary in the first place based on how many kids have died. So I think the number is so small that there's no actual need. So safety and efficacy is almost moot. What different, you know, it's like, why would I need a safe and effective vaccine for Ebola? I'm not getting exposed to Ebola. So how safe and effective it is irrelevant. I don't need it. Let's look at Florida. Of the 70,478 people that died in Florida, how many were kids under 5 years old? Now, if parents knew this number, if parents of children under five knew what that number was, don't you think that would impact their decision whether or not to inoculate their kid?
You would think it would, but we have to take a look at the entire childhood vaccine schedule, and that tells us our answer right there, because they don't care. They're still afraid because they're being told to be afraid. So half of those, actually more than half of the diseases that they supposedly inoculate kids for growing up don't even exist in this country anymore. And if they do, right. they're easily treatable and everything's fine. And they're still pumping their kids with it. So, you know, I think they have blinders on, fear blinders.
You're right. You're right. You know, kids are getting inoculated from all kinds of diseases that, you know, mumps, measles, you know, I don't know that it is or isn't necessary, but I think you're right. They don't question it. Hopefully, the fact that it's not FDA approved for children under five, the fact that it's only FDA authorized, it's not FDA approved, and it's authorized for emergency use. So the question then is, well, how many kids under five in Florida died that it is an emergency, or is it? And could Ron DeSantis petition to say there is no pediatric emergency in Florida, therefore the EUA is invalid for children in Florida? So here's the numbers. Let me give you some. I know you're driving and can't write this down. I'll email this to Greg.
Well, we have podcasts. You know, yeah. See if you can catch on the podcast, you know, for any of the facts. That's why these things are so important to put on podcasts. Go ahead.
All right, so here's the numbers. So in Florida, you've got 70,478 people that died with COVID. The number of kids under five is 27. The number of school-age kids between 5 and 17 in the whole state is 55.
We need an end campaign, Tiffany. we need
it's
to get
crazy.
This information
it's
on
crazy.
Billboards,
you know,
in the media.
There's no need.
Yeah.
Yeah. This establishes that there is no medical pediatric. You know, there's no pediatric medical emergency. There's no obstetric medical emergency based on the data, not hearsay, based on the CDC's data.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this gets back to my original question for Tiffany. How best can we market this? How can we design something? That, you know, can we work directly with DeSantis office? Do we have contacts there? Can we, just as I want to be on a panel that either Senator Rand Paul or Ron Johnson set up again to introduce citizen legislation to Congress directly, because I'd be right there. Is this something we can do directly?
Yeah.
We've got Surgeon General Lapido, who's fabulous.
Yeah.
Tiffany, got some contacts there?
Fantastic.
Anybody we... Who, you know somebody we can talk to?
We're working on it. We're
okay.
close to being very much in the circles of Lodafo and DeSantis. And, you know, I think Florida is really setting the stage with what the rest of the country can do. And I also think that the corporations in Florida will also help do that. For example, I just saw an article today that Publix, which is a major grocery chain out here, they will not be administering vaccines. They came out with a statement saying they will not be administering vaccines to children under five. And nothing else needs to be said about it. They're not doing it. I think that, public corporations doing things like that are going to be what's going to help spiral other corporations to do it and people to talk about it. And that's the opportunity you have for putting articles out and statements out that actually include those numbers so that people can read them and actually think about them in context. And so,
I'll get you two in contact after the show. Yeah, I'll get you guys in contact. Tiffany, is there an obsolete vaccine list, something where those vaccines that you mentioned are the diseases we don't have anymore and yet we're still giving vaccines for? Is there a list of what I would now call obsolete vaccines?
Not anywhere formally, but I could get it to you very easily. The data is super readily available. Yeah.
Let's post it. Let's get it out there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can include that with the other doctors who can, we can get it to them and they can then take it to all the panels and all the media and all the things that everybody else is doing. I'm sure John would be interested as well if he doesn't know already.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Okay. I want to take all the vaccines, right? If I take 10 a day, I'll be as healthy as can be, and I can walk barefoot in Needle Park and swim in the Ganges, right? Called the logical absurd. That's the logical absurd, is if these things are so good for you, well, I'm going to go get 10 in each arm tomorrow.
Well, that's
right?
that's a question
diamonds,
I haven't raised.
Fabulous.
I wanted to raise that question, too.
I want them all. I want every Ebola shot, right?
How about vaccine addiction? And this is probably, we'll see who else is on the panel. Jim's not still back. Vaccine addiction. How many people are so scared, by everything they've heard, they're getting multiple vaccines from multiple sources, not telling them. And we might have people with 20, 30, 50, 100 COVID shots.
Yeah.
Just because they're scared.
It's actually Jim? A kind of form of Munchausen syndrome.
Okay. Which is?
Well, Munchausen syndrome is where a patient develops a psychiatric need to have aggressive medical interventions.
And that would include vaccine addiction.
Therapies, vaccine addiction. I think it's an extension of it.
Are we seeing that out there?
Yeah, there is some. I mean, there's cognitive dissonance between, obviously, the numbers that John Cullen is talking about and individuals like yourself and like the panel here and Tiffany and people whose eyes are open. We see these numbers and the lack of need for a potentially lethal, dangerous intervention.
No, I was just going to say, let's go back to what Brandon was sort of saying. You know, he says, as we get through at least this year, we do need more money, but we don't just need money for vaccines for children. Eventually, we need more money to plan for a second or the second pandemic. So you want to talk about dry run? What's going on here?
I just want to interact on that note. You know, we've talked about these other epidemics and pandemics and such. You know, this is what I believe. I suspect very strongly, you know, we've had 11.39 billion people injected in this planet. As Ben Marble has suggested, it's over 4, maybe close to 5 billion people because several have had multiple shots. So we have completely destroyed the immune systems in the vast majority of people living on this planet. So what I believe is some of the horrible future pandemics that we're going to see are going to be that of opportunistic infections. That is infections caused by pathological aggressive infections that are caused by usually organisms that remain at bay that are held in check by a healthy immune system. And that's what I think is coming out with the monkey packs. You know, is it going to be a problem in somebody that has a normal immune system? No. Is it going to be a problem in a select group of individuals at high risk? Define your behavior, you know, male with male sex, just let's use that as an example. It's exactly what we're seeing with monkeypox. That's the exact pattern that we saw in the early 80s.
Well, monkeypox is gay men are primarily being affected by this. Let's be blunt.
That's what I read.
Yeah, well, I guess.
He said men having sex with men.
I missed that part. But yeah, but that's what's going on. Okay, yeah. So why can't we say that?
My point is that in 1980, we had the exact same issue with the emergence of the acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or HIV,
right,
which, by the way, those are not the same. So we're getting a vaccine-induced VAIDS. And all these opportunistic infections, you know, whether it's monkeypox or whether it's CMV or whether it's chickenpox, varicella, shingles, Epstein-Barr virus, all the other unusual viral causes of pericarditis and pulmonary infections, they're all going to come out of the woodwork, including cancers, cytomegalovirus, toxoplasmosis, huge TB. A lot of these diseases, if you have a healthy immune system, your immune system keeps them in check. That's what I believe is happening with the outbreak in men having sex with each other, the exact same thing that happened in 1980.
You think that's
are
also
men
what's
a lower
yeah?
because? All right, go ahead, John. Then I got a Tiffany question.
Do you think that that's also what's leading to polio in the UK? They're talking about a polio outbreak in the UK. You think it's the same thing?
Hepatitis.
So both the hepatitis and the polio outbreak. You think it probably due to these weakened immune systems from everybody now with with spike proteins.
That's right. That's right.
Actually, I want to catch you. Hold up. I need to say something. This is Dr. Artis.
He's back. Go ahead.
About the polio vaccine. About the polio outbreak in the UK, this incident that's being reported. You guys need to go read it. It is actually declared and it's actually determined. This is actually vaccine induced polio. They actually describe it. This polio they're finding in the sewer water is coming from the vaccinated for polio. This is a vaccine created polio virus they're finding in sewage. But just so you know, this is another obvious, just disgusting, blatant understanding and observation that the vaccine agenda is horrific and a failure. It is not natural polio. They said, I even read it this morning, it is actually from people who were vaccinated for polio. It is a vaccine-created polio virus in the water of the UK. Stop trusting the vaccines. It's ridiculous. In the same articles, they said this polio derived from a vaccine is actually, they believe, being blamed on people traveling to the UK who got a live polio virus, but that this could be a threat to those who haven't gotten the inactive polio virus vaccines in the UK. And they actually said, the NHS there in the UK said, I read it this morning, that they are now going to physically call all parents in the UK who have children of record who have not gotten their polio vaccines and tell them, because we're finding this vaccine-caused polio in the water, in your water, your children can actually possibly get polio that was actually created problematically by the vaccine agenda. It is ridiculously heinous. Do not buy into it. Do not go get these shots. Do not encourage more vaccines. This is all they're doing is more fear-mongering propaganda. It's ridiculous. Just so you know,
what happened to
this
chlorine
is not
in the water?
Natural polio.
They cured polio.
No.
We cured polio the first time with chlorine in the swimming pools and better sewage,
They're testing the sewer. They're not testing the fresh water. They're finding it in the sewage system, meaning people have been inoculated and go pee. And
right.
When
they're shedding. They're shedding.
Right. When they defecate, they get rid of that virus, and they find it in the sewer, not in the fresh water. It's not in the fresh water.
No, I'm not saying the fresh water, but it used to be in swimming pools, and it used to be the sewer. Polio is a fecal bacteria, as I understand it. It's transmitted through water. It's like E. coli in the water. This is how it works, from what I understand. Chlorine was the biggest thing. It wasn't the polio vaccine that cured it. It was chlorine. It was better treated water, as I understand the history. We've got about 7 minutes left. Here's a Tiffany question. If you were marketing, if you were working for a government pharmaceutical industrial fascist complex, is there any better product than one that is advertised as a cure but actually causes the disease, that it strips the immune system it supposedly boosts and it gives the diseases it supposedly prevents? Is there any more disgusting, evil, yet very efficient marketing scheme than that for a government pharmaceutical industrial complex? Tiffany? I know, big question. Are you still there? Oh, she's still there. That was a great question. Oh, she's driving.
That was probably
a traffic. Who wants that question in the
that
last
was
7 minutes?
Brilliant.
I have my moments. But the person I want to ask isn't there. Brian, what do you think? And then we'll get to John, and then we'll get to, and Jim. Brian, agree? Oh, he's gone too. What's going on with you guys? Jim, you said it was brilliant. Is that really the problem? Is that what it comes down to?
I agree that your question was brilliant and that Tiffany's not on the line anymore, and I'm not a marketer. I plead the fifth.
Well, you don't have to be an expert in everything. I'm not. That's why I bring you folks on. So I can ask different areas of expertise. Brian, are you back at all by chance?
Sorry, yeah, it got cut off for some reason when I got in my car. Sorry.
Yeah,
it happens. What was the question?
Yeah. Well, is there any more dangerous and yet efficient scheme for a government industrial pharmaceutical fascist conglomerate than creating vaccines and marketing them through fear that not only destroy the immune system they supposedly are boosting and give the very diseases they're saying that they're preventing in the most evil way?
This is by far the most brilliant thing they have figured out to get people to volunteer themselves to inject themselves, volunteer themselves to get injected, it's very, very similar. You have to understand, people are brainwashed and they are being guided by cult leaders, and they are using every tactic every successful cult leader has ever used. Think about Jim Jones's town, right? This guy had them convinced that they needed to trust him and only him. And to protect their entire community, the best thing to do is to drink my Kool-Aid. Drink it, and we're all just going to die. Applegate, what do you do? We're going to go join this spaceship. We're going to get off this damn planet. Drink our Kool-Aid, the Kool-Aid I made. Everybody going to lay down your beds and die. It is an amazing cult tactic to get these individuals around the world, these innocent human beings, 8 billion people, now 5 billion per Ben Marvel, Dr. Marvel, that have signed themselves up to volunteer themselves, their children, their grandparents, to get these shots, to volunteer themselves through fear that there's this invisible thing you can't see, you can't control, and that those who don't get the vaccine are responsible for making the other people sick. It is the most incredibly evil plot and successful plot to manipulate the masses I've ever seen.
Then that's what we need our movie to be. That's what we need to get the information out. Movie scenes seem to work. You know, so that's what we need to present to Dinesh D'Souza and say, hey, dude, we need your help. Tiffany agrees. She just texted me. So, and her signal's lost, but she at least heard what we said, so we'll get her back next time. John, I got a last question for you, and this is someone probably have to pick up next week. As the charts I sent you from the CDC proved, COVID was basically gone by July of 2020, and yet they resurrected it with either false numbers or, you know, the masks and everything else, the lockdowns to perpetuate this until the vaccines got here. Mm-hmm. Do you have any data from the CDC? Like, can you confirm, tell me more about, or like I said, we may have to do this next week, that this really was through natural causes before they geared up with all the preventions and the snake jabs? You know, this was pretty much done, wasn't it, by July of 2020?
It was. And so the theory that I've been putting forward is that you can't hide one pandemic without the other.
Oh.
All right, so
okay.
We know...
Yeah, I think I know where you're going with this, yeah.
All right, so we know what the number one comorbidity is, and we know that only 5% of the people that died with just COVID. So when we start looking at the numbers from this new perspective, wearing these new glasses... It starts to become clear that, wait a second, there's two pandemics here. There's an influenza pandemic that started long before COVID. We had 4,000 people dying a week in January, February, March. This is unprecedented. We never had that many people dying every week in a row. That's never happened before. And then all the news goes to COVID. Now, if you wanted to cover up one pandemic, you might need another virus that presents identically that came from China. And that keeps everybody away from Walter Reed.
Where they had the influenza, Spanish flu. So
it was resurrected by Dr. Fauci's team in 2005.
So did they change things in July when COVID was basically gone of 2020? Did they introduce a new thing? How did they preserve COVID?
When H1N1 gets out, which is in the summer of 2019 in Australia, so you see the biggest outbreak of influenza in the history of Australia, in the last 100 years of Australia, is in the summer of 2019, and I'll show you the WHO charts for that. So it starts in Australia, it starts to spread around the world, and then in week 11 through 14, it disappears from the world. All of a sudden, influenza is just gone, according to the WHO, in weeks 11 through 14 of 2020. And that's way too suspicious. Right now, we know from the CDC, 4,000 people a week are dying from it before COVID arrives. And then to your point, July of 2021, it looks like it's gone. July of 2021.
No, I said 2020. I said 2020. Oh. That's on the CDC chart. Oh. I sent you that CDC chart. The death count was like 300 for the whole country.
All right, so in both summertime is the lowest point.
Okay.
So week 26 of 2021, and then it comes back again. We have two more big peaks. So I'm looking at the data right now again.
We've only got a minute. We're going to have to pick this up next week, but go ahead. Just imagine
that there's two pandemics that are just keeping, you know, that are working in parallel, in synchronicity, right. as far as how many people are dying from each. So as one goes up, the other goes up. As the other goes down, the other goes down. Well, that's for 2.5 years? Two different viruses, huh? When did that happen before? Show me some evidence of that. Show me evidence that this phenomenon that I'm looking at on the chart right now has ever happened in history, because it hasn't. And right now we have about 1 million people that have died from influenza PNI in the USA mm-hmm. since right. October 2019.
So that's fascinating. Now, and then we have to figure out what remdesivir and the ventilators have to do with influenza. But that's for next week. Thank you all. We've done it again. This has been fascinating. Thanks to everybody that called in for even whatever time you had available. Let's do it again. If you want to change the time, talk to me. But I think this seems to be working out pretty well. Hopefully Judy will be coming back next week to join us as well. That's it. Let's do it again next week. Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Our legislative site is writeyourlaws.com, WRITEYOURLAWS. And if you want to catch anybody else's information, then listen to the beginning of the show or as they report their contact information. And we will do it again next Thursday, 10 a.m. Central Time. And the rest of the country, you'll figure out.